It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Here we go, off and running on this 30th, this penultimate day of March 2021, because I like to use words like penultimate. Hi, I'm Robin, and it is Titanic Tuesday on the horn, like I said, the 30th day of March 2021, and we have plenty of Titanic intellect, Titanic right-wing intellect to commemorate on the program this evening. I would, I'd never say celebrate, because it's nothing to be proud of. But we do. And I highly suggest that if you are listening live and not podcast, if you are listening live, well, go ahead and make your listening experience even more enjoyable. And head over to headon.live and click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and get yourself immediately greeted by Otto DeShot and Squeaky, and more to come before the tardy bell rings, right? It's a wonderful time. A lot of good conversation takes place in the Horn chat room during the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Oh, yes, a good time is, in fact, had by all. And if you've never tried it, you should. If you haven't been by in a while, come on back by. The gang still remembers you. And, just have fun. Have a good time. And just a quick note for this next-to-last day of March 2021. There is no debate, there is no question whatsoever. This has been the absolute loveliest day of 2021 thus far. Here inside the fabulous Horn Studios of the magnificent Kincaid Mansion, it's 75 degrees and the air conditioner is laboring. Outside, it is sunny. I haven't seen a cloud all day. And it's 73 degrees. I think it probably got up closer to 75 outside. I went outside and the flowering crabapple trees are in bloom. The flowering pears are in bloom. I saw a tulip tree. Not sure if it was a tulip maple or a tulip poplar or a tulip Joshua tree. But it was in just an absolute riot of beautiful pinks. I saw a wild cherry tree in bloom. It's happening. Unfortunately, it's happening. Well, welcome to climate change. It's happening a mite premature is one way to put it. Because this is so psychotic. So we're going to get, we got up to 75. It's backing off now. It's not going to be too bad to see it. The low tonight is 55 here. Yeah. Robin, and now to Robin in the Weather Center. But all of that is for the purpose of pointing out that April Fool's Day, and even this whole idea of March out like a lion, that so-called old wives' tale, and I don't know why it is that the wives get the slur, but oh yes, I do, because patriarchy. April Fool's Day, the high is 36 and the low is 19. Tonight's low is 55 here. Tomorrow is 28 and 19 on Thursday night. A little bit more kerosene to burn, a little bit more trashing of the climate to do. Not much I can do to avoid it. But that's going to be brutal. And I don't think we see the sun again until Friday. And we don't see the 70s again until, I think, Monday. But spring's coming, and the sap is rising. Never mind. Not going to do that. No. But nonetheless, it was a beautiful day, and I'm in a great mood. And I'm looking forward to a wonderful, wonderful program this evening. Well, I mean, wonderful if you know your idea of a good time is cataloging right-wing insanity, but you get the idea. Let's see. See, I multitask, and so consequently, there are these little pauses. Of course, we will have, when you talk about Titanic intellects, it will be hard on a day like this not to mention the Titanic intellects handling the bought and paid for by the cop union defense of Derek Chauvin, right? Yeah. But we'll get to that all in good time. Every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude, and this program is no different. And so on each and every program, we start the program by thanking the partial sponsors who are our subscribers via Patreon, PayPal, and the United States Mail. And so, it happens this way. There are no subscribers for the 30th day of the month. It's that and the 31st. Those are the only where we don't have at least one subscriber. But so as far as the fundraising goal is concerned, and of course I'll thank the Patreon subscribers tomorrow on the last day of the month, because that's how that breaks out. But that leaves the fundraising goal to finish March at $598. We got $2 into yesterday's fundraising toward the end of the program with our dear sister Jude, and $590, and then I guess we could just say that it's $898 to finish March. And between today and tomorrow, we need to raise $898 to be fully funded for the previous March, pardon the nick-ups. So if you'd like to help out, the interface there is at headon.live, right there on the main page. And Joe and Paula had a thing yesterday where the PayPal interface thought that they were spammers because that PayPal interface, we didn't write it, we just plug it in. So that's a mess. I mean, not a mess, but for some reason or another. Anyway, if you'd like to be a part of one of those partial sponsors of the program, just head over to headon.live, and it would be great if we could finish yesterday's funding, get into part of today's, because there's stuff that is still waiting to be paid for the month, because that's how, what did Ed Schultz call it? Oh, so many years ago. Bake sale radio. That's how bake sale radio survives. Yeah. And hopefully we will, and hopefully there will be an April and all of that. Everybody had a lot of fun with that impromptu thing that Dave number 11 started yesterday afternoon with the little musical snippet that stopped the Earth from turning on its axis for him until we sorted that one out. That was so much fun. I had responses from the podcast, crowd, pointing at, and you know, some got it right, some got it wrong. Thomas and Jessica, in particular, got it right. It was almost like a little indignance. Well, of course, that's the theme from a summer place, and Jessica pointing out that that's one of her favorite instrumental pieces. And it is. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And I think it was absolutely genius. Well, we're wearing out absolutely this afternoon, aren't we? It is absolutely genius to hear that worked in a 1974 live Steely Dan piece. So, and Joy in Ann Arbor, our pal Joy, said, make this a weekly thing. See if you can come up with one of these every week, and we'll just keep playing, because Joy got it right, too. And Dave didn't mean to do it, but the fact that you couldn't use Shazam to sort it out made it even more devious. But it was a lot of fun. And so there's other stuff to go into. But I came up with something, and I know there's no way to do this every evening, but something else was triggered in my brain, my old DJ brain, when I read a science story, and we'll get to the Titanic intellects in a minute, but when I read a science story, and then of course our pal Joy sent along a clip via Facebook to me from SCTV, because it's kind of an inside joke with us. An old Rick Moranis bit of Rick Moranis playing a DJ, you know, with that voice, you know. And now, here's the new hit, the brand new video for Christopher Cross's Ride Like the Wind. And it's all about Rick Moranis playing Michael McDonald, who drives like a bat out of hell to get to the studio, runs into the studio, sings, such a long way to go. Because that's a terrible, terrible, terrible Michael McDonald impression. But it's a great skit. You should look it up. It's funny. It's terribly funny. But anyway, it's just kind of weird the way music plays around in our minds. It's not just me. It's not just the old DJ brain. It's anybody who's ever loved music and has a storehouse, you know, because our brains are the most capacious MP3 players ever in the history of cognition, unless maybe it's, you know, some bird. But that's not even a player. I mean, they're actually performing, right? So I saw this cool science story. And the real diehards will immediately go, oh, I know what she's talking about. So the story was published at The Conversation, and it describes a new exoplanet, KOI-5AB. And these weird little coincidences that just come along blow my mind, because Agnes and I have been spending the time after the program watching movies nominated, and in a way, because of the pandemic, with just about all of the Academy Award nominees having been released to streaming services, it's a unique opportunity to see things that I probably wouldn't otherwise see. Until it came to streaming video, as opposed to being sent straight to it. So what? Last week we watched The Trial of the Chicago 7, which, as Joy told me, was it was every bit as awesome as she said it was going to be. She said, oh, you'll love that. And she was absolutely right. And last night, tonight is going to be Mank. But last night, and I didn't see where it was nominated or what it was nominated for, but it showed up in there in the list of Netflix nominees. The George Clooney directed and starred in film Midnight Sky. And once again, it's a science fiction dystopia story about the end of human life on planet Earth. Yeah, it's a real pop the popcorn, happy time kind of movie. No. But no spoilers or anything. It was a good watch. I enjoyed the hell out of it. Apparently, the critic who didn't so much review it as pen a crushing brief against it for Variety didn't so much. But I did, and it had a, there was a little hidden snapper in there, and I said something to Agnes when something happened, and it turned out that what I said was true. One of us will usually do that to the other somewhere during the course of a film that we've never seen before. It was a lot of fun. Followed that up with a Netflix documentary about the rise of the Tokugawa shogunate in 16th century Japan, because tastes. Weird. Just strange. But anyway, KOI-5AB. A newly discovered planet. An exoplanet. Somewhere not in our solar system. And what made me think about Midnight Sky was the fact that the discovery of a never-before-found moon figures in Midnight Sky. But this isn't in our solar system. It is actually a newly discovered planet in a star system that consists of three separate stars. And the article points out that the discovery was only made because of group cooperation between big teams of astronomers who, using different telescopes and different techniques of observation, came to the conclusion that this planet exists. And what the article of The Conversation points out is there is a stereotype that lone genius scientists make discoveries without any help from others. This is propagated by the prestigious Nobel Prize, which is awarded most to two or three scientists at a time. But as they point out, most of the big discoveries in astronomy and physics are team sports, as it were, because it takes multiple different points of view in order to sort out the data for things that cannot necessarily be seen with the augmented eye, let alone the naked eye. And so this exoplanet has popped up, and they have identified this exoplanet in a triple star system. And you got to wonder what sunrise and sunset are like there. Is there ever a night? Maybe. Don't know. But the cool thing is, it was thought to be impossible. Nothing like that exists. But life has a way of imitating art. And so where maybe it was mentioned in a science fiction story and now it comes true, but in particular this story of this exoplanet, I read the story, and immediately I realized I had heard such a thing referred to in a song. And this is way more obscure than, say, the theme to A Summer Place. But it is nonetheless referred to. The song was released as a single. And at the risk of pissing off the Digital Millennium Copyright Act Maoists, maybe a few notes. Maybe just a few notes from the song that I immediately thought of when I read the story. We don't know anything about habitability or whether or not it's the planet's in the Goldilocks zone or whether there's water or water ice. No. but we know it's there. And it's part of, you know, thousands of exoplanets that are popping up. And the article at The Conversation is kind of, for a science-y article, or a layperson's article, it's information rich. And it talks about things like the orbits being not like what we usually think about. The size of KOI-5AB is 7 times the radius of the Earth. And it's a gas giant planet. Maybe a little bit smaller and denser than Saturn. So it's out as a place for us to live. And, well, the fact of its distance from the Earth lets it out, too. But maybe there are moons. Just like Saturn has moons. Just like Jupiter has moons. Gas giant planets. And so with that in mind, a few snippets. No fair cheating in using Shazam. But, well, that may be the only way. But anyway, just a little snippet before we get to the lyric. Like I said, this is the kind of thing that Dan Fisher specializes in with his Beat the Intro game on Zoom. Well, let's just, and it's a cool song anyway. Yeah, isn't that just cool and kind of jazzy and funky? And most of the aficionados and aficionadas will immediately guess at least who the performer is, because the style is kind of unmistakable. But as we did yesterday, long about the top of the beginning of the second hour, we'll do the big reveal. And in this case, it's a little more esoteric than it was yesterday. And these things just happen unbidden, so it's not like this is going to become a feature or anything. It just happens. Around a little bit after the beginning of the second hour or thereabouts, I'll reveal the title, but it's not in the title and it's not in the music. It's in a particular chunk of the lyric. And once we see that, or once we hear that, you'll know why it was that my little DJ brain went, oh, wait, of course, yes. And the article's author writing, being a gas giant, a gas planet, we couldn't actually stand on the surface, but if we could hover on the edge of its atmosphere with our spaceship, what would we see? Maybe dark brown gray clouds. The author writes, ferocious winds. In the sky, you'd see one sun 17 times larger than our sun. There would also be another much smaller sun, only 0.5% as bright as our sun. And the third star would move a lot more slowly relative to the background stars. And even though it's a long way away, it would still appear much brighter than the full moon in our sky. So, whoa, just think about that. And that's daytime. And would there ever be a night? I don't know. Because the author says, full darkness would only be available for brief snatches every couple of hundred years when all three stars wandered into the same position of the celestial sphere. Imagine having to wait for 200 years just for night to fall. Living beings on such a planet would probably make nightfall, well, maybe everywhere in the universe doesn't have religion. But odds are there would be a great philosophical thingamajig, and there'd probably be temples. But Vol is hungry. Mm-hmm. There's our obligatory Star Trek reference for the evening. So give that some thought. And a little bit of an update, because, and if this doesn't qualify as Titanic intellect, I don't know what does. Let's consider the case. No, but Brother Deacon Asa already out there guessing. Let's see. In answer to Brother Deacon's question, not quite. No, this is so Titanic intellect. This is so all speed ahead, full speed ahead into the iceberg. And it's a story concerning Lieutenant G.D. Langford, because the goddess of irony is a good goddess, and she's immediately made this guy a clown with his own initials. Lieutenant, goddammit, Langford is a lieutenant with the Georgia State Police, and he's the asshole who arrested Georgia State Representative Park Cannon for, wait for it, the desperate and dangerous crime of being black while knocking on a door. Because you'll recall last week we had the account of Representative Park Cannon knocking on the door, trying to get in and actually watch the little Republican white supremacist, Brian Kemp, and his pals, as Kemp signed into law the ridiculous voter suppression statute that makes it a felony to hand someone a bottle of water if they're standing in line to vote. Or handling, say, a diabetic voter standing in line for maybe her eighth hour, a package of peanut butter crackers to keep her from going into hypoglycemic shock. And so it is that we now know that it was Lieutenant G.D. Langford who has now filed his 13-page incident report of the takedown of Representative Park Cannon. He recounts that she knocked on the door and he said, "In the name of the law, stop knocking on Governor Brian Kemp's private second-floor office door in the Georgia Capitol." This is, bear in mind, before we get to the punchline, this is one lone, small, black woman who happens to be an elected member of the Georgia State House of Representatives, okay? And she knocked again. And he said, "Stop, in the name of the law, knocking on that door." Well, it is Georgia, and Georgia did give us Lester Maddox, and Lester Maddox did used to carry around an axe handle, did he not, that he said he would use on anyone who tried to break the Jim Crow laws about where people could and couldn't sit or couldn't dine or could or couldn't, and there we are again, get a drink of water. And it's why Georgia State Police Lieutenant G.D. Langford said that he felt he had to arrest her that forms the, what the fuck, Titanic Tuesday portion of the program. In his 13-page report, Lieutenant G.D. Langford said, "The events of January 6th, the events of January 6th, 2021 at the U.S. Capitol were in the back of my mind," as he arrested one black woman for knocking on one white governor's door. You got that? Yep. Lieutenant G.D. Langford, who apparently has a feverish imagination, to say the least, somehow imagined, and I'm trying to sort this out in my own head, and I've been working on it all day, not having a lot of luck, trying to enter the imaginative process of Lieutenant G.D. Langford, hard-hitting member of the Georgia State Police, protecting Georgians from deadly and dangerous door knockers for Yeah, if I had it to hand, I would immediately play the clip of Gene Wilder in Young Frankenstein saying, "What knockers?" No. He's some kind of super cop, that G.D. Langford. I guess, given the fact that she was dragged away, Representative Cannon was. Thanks, Dave, number 11. I'll get to it in a minute. Yeah, G.D. Langford somehow or another looked at one small, lone black woman and immediately imagined the hordes of, I guess, black people who rushed the Capitol on January 6th, you know, the horde of black people who weren't there on January 6th. That was a, sorry, G.D., horde of dangerous white people carrying MAGA flags. I don't think Representative Park Cannon had a MAGA flag with her, or any bear spray, or maybe an American flag to stab people with. I don't think she even set up a gallows outside of Brian Kemp's door. But no. Lieutenant G.D. Langford, who apparently at that very time was filling his shorts with fear and loathing and dread, said the events of January 6, 2021 at the U.S. Capitol were in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling the distance from the back of Lieutenant G.D. Langford's mind to the front of Lieutenant G.D. Langford's mind ain't much of a trip. Shades of Ron Johnson. You know, I was not afraid of those patriotic white Americans who were rushing the Capitol and attacking the Capitol because I knew they were America-loving, patriotic, law-abiding white people. If it had been a bunch of Negroes, I might have been afraid. If it had been Black Lives Matter, you know, or maybe Antifa, because those people scare me.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's a link to find his report, but the story itself comes from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and you know, Representative Cannon was wearing her Representative Cannon badge, I think. There was no mistake. She wasn't wearing her official Black Lives Matter, Antifa, communist infiltrator, pinko, neoliberal establishment shill badge or anything like that. And the head, I'd love to know who wrote the headline at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Trooper who arrested Georgia lawmaker says he was wary of a January 6th type of attack, from one woman. Greg Bluestein is the reporter for the AJC on the story. He was quite sure Lieutenant G.D. Langford of the Georgia State Police was, that if he had not arrested Park Cannon for illegally being black while knocking on a governor's door, that other protesters would have been emboldened to follow her and also knock on the good God fearing upstanding Bible believing Christ centered evangelical fundamentalist amosexual Christian Republican governor's door. Yeah. It, right. I didn't want the protesters to attempt to gain entry into a secure part of the Capitol. I believed Cannon's actions of obstructing law enforcement in front of agitated protesters to constitute a breach of the peace. Oh, Jesus. I can't believe that any prosecutor of any degree of competence would even dare to take this thing another step further in court. And reporter Bluestein pointing out, she stood alone in the moments before she gently knocked on a side door in the Georgia Capitol's rotunda seeking access to Kemp's remarks about a measure she adamantly opposed. Gently knocked. You know, coming to a federal defense of white insurrectionists everywhere. You can imagine playing the video. Remember with the riot shield and the against the window of the Capitol of the United States of America?
That defendant was merely gently knocking to gain access to the people's house. That's all. Mm-hmm.
And yes, she was dragged away, Representative Park Cannon was, to the Fulton County Jail, where she was held for hours. And understand, Lieutenant G.D. Langford said that he warned her he'd arrest her. Little black lady, I will arrest you. I don't care if you're a member of the legislature. I will arrest you. See, I got my gray trousers and my blue shirt with all these patches all over it and my stupid Smokey the Bear hat on. I got me a badge, and look here, I got guns and tasers and shit, and I will arrest your black ass.
Yeah.
And then I noticed that a crowd of other demonstrators were gathered in the lobby, and they began to get louder as she was refusing to follow my commands, me being a white man and her being a black woman. I stepped back, I crossed my feetses in an attempt to de-escalate the situation by remaining calm, and that's when she done it. Mm-hmm. That's when that little black lady done it again. She knocked on the door again. And that's when I knowed that I had to grab her right wrist. And another officer had to help me handcuff her because she was struggling against us. And then I told her, I said, stop making it worse. Because she was dragging her feet. You know, like those people will. She stomped on my right foot several times with her high heels. I had to file a police officer's workers' comp claim for my high-heel-stomped foot because I am a delicate little Lieutenant G.D. Langford of the Georgia State Police.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this little snowflake, pardon me when I say this fucking fascist. Can I say this? Will y'all forgive me? This fucking pig. You know, when it oinks and it's got, you know, that's a pig. Lieutenant G.D. Langford of the Georgia State Police is a pig. Yeah. And so that's why when he filed his 13-page report, he included a color glossy photograph with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of it. His scuffed boot. That woman, that uppity black woman, she done scuffed his boot. No, really. And then Sergeant N. Jenkins got into the act, too. He said, a staffer for Governor Kemp done got panicked and said, lock the office down and move the governor and first lady from the ceremonial office because the side door was shaking so violently they thought it was going to be breached. Yeah. And you know what would have happened if that door had been breached, right? Yeah. A horde of upset, peaceful protesters would have filed in, sat down, held hands, and sung, "We Shall Overcome." And you know what? We can't have that in the Georgia State Police. We can't have uppity Negroes sitting in the governor's office singing, "We Shall Overcome." Why, it done give the First Lady of Georgia a plum case of the vapors and the fantods. There's only one problem.
in the same report, Officer Vince Mooney says, the crowd was attempting to breach the wooden doors. And we briefly secured the governor and first lady for a short period of time and resumed his live conference a short time later. We had to give the first lady a margarita and a Darvon and Fanta on the fainting couch until she recovered her composure. Hey, on the other hand, Mr. Bluestein and other members of the staff of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution actually went and interviewed people who were there at the time, and they said, Tamara Stevens, an activist who was with Representative Cannon, said, nobody touched that door. We didn't go anywhere near that door. We followed the police officers who were taking Park into the elevator. There was no attempt flat out to breach the door. Oh, it was a shaking. It was a shaking, said Officer Mooney. Mm-hmm. Jesus. White supremacy dies hard. If you want to see the report itself, you can go to AJC.com. Trooper who arrested Georgia lawmaker says he was wary of January 6th type of attack. God bless them. Oh, those poor little sissy troopers. There's a whole cop riot's worth of Georgia State Police, and they are pants shitting scared of a little black lady. Well, you know how that goes. Yeah, I guess. All right. No, I had a note from tape number 11 a couple of minutes ago. It was. That was my little chuckle. Dave number 11. Why are you doing a show when we need to hear the clip again? Okay. Let's do that. And back we go. Okay, that was a little bit longer clip. That was every bit of 32 seconds, yeah. And I warn you, it was released as a single, but it's still obscure, from a less successful album than the one that preceded it. But after the trouble's good. After you identify the song, then you got to find the lyric that led to the right. Mm-hmm. We'll try it again if you still need a little bit of a boost. Let's see. What's says Ron and Raleigh. I guess she didn't respect his authority. If you were to ask someone what Officer G.D. Langford looks like, I bet most people would nail it. Yeah, I know. Skinhead. Probably rather portly. At least one of them. And Megan is might worked up. What are these fuckers doing? How do they not understand that they don't look tough or strong when they pull this shit? All they look is scared fucking shitless of black people. All they've done is invite all the black women in Georgia to come down to Kemp's office and sit themselves outside his door. Lock him in his office if he's that afraid of black women. Make him piss his pants, for Christ's sakes. That'll teach him to go downtown to Atlanta to his office in the Capitol. He'll probably, you know, the Georgia governor's mansion sits right there pretty much in Buckhead. Big old estate with kind of a plantation housey looking affair. It kind of sits on a hill there on West Paces Ferry. He'll probably, big spiky wrought iron fence all the way around it.
Shit, he may be like Julius Caesar's co-consul and just go home for the rest of his term. Sit there and wait to watch for birds to land on a wire and declare that it's an auspice that says black folks shouldn't be voting in Georgia. Mm-hmm. I think Caesar's co-consul was Metellus. I think his name was Metellus. Yeah. Right. Yeah. GD. Mm-hmm. Now, the GD was not lost on Dave and the Blind. No. Jimmy in the Great Northwest says, yeah, Robin, it's a beautiful day, but then again, every day is a beautiful day. Sunny here in the Emerald City. Not a cloud in the sky. You go, girl. Keep on keeping me up to date. Well, that's, you know, that's my job as Robin the Progressive Weather Girl, I guess. Mm-hmm. Knocking While Black, a visual, Representative Park Cannon standing, knocking on the door with Lieutenant G.D. Langford standing there, shaking his finger at her. No shit, shaking his finger at her. That's the photograph on the left, Knocking While Black. Meanwhile, Knocking While White, a vast and violent horde of maggots trying to force their way in an act of war into the capital of the United States. Thanks for that, Dave. David, sorry. Stephen, New York. Notice the difference between January 6th and an incident with the office of G.D. Langford? Number of officers greater than crowd of protester. Wait a minute. The cowbell is for crowd of protester. That's good. And the funny thing is, as they're dragging her away in that photograph, and all you can see is, I guess, Lieutenant G.D. Langford and his very, very pale-scalped compadre, and they've handcuffed Representative Cannon behind her back, which is a form of, which in itself is a brutality, especially in light of the fact that it's not like she slapped them or spit on them or, you know, punched their freaking lights out or, you know, anything that they damned well deserved. And it looks like they're dragging her down a hallway in the Georgia Capitol. Alongside an interpretive series of photographs. Georgia's connection to the, can't quite read it, Georgia's connection to the something, but I got a feeling that that's going to be highly ironic for anybody who can sort out what it is that Georgia's got a connection to in the hall where Representing Park Cannon is being dragged. That's Shakespearean, you know, that's when you put the little accent ague over the E in an ED, and it becomes dragged. Yes. Right. Nope. We have an early guess from Megan. It is not September by Earth, Wind, and Fire. And even if it was, you would have to find then the lyric that reminded me. It's really unfair, this game, isn't it? That reminded me of the science story. But no, it's not September by Earth, Wind, and Fire, as much as I love that song. I absolutely do. And as to Lieutenant G.D. Langford, great big manly he-man lieutenant of the Georgia State Police, David in South Carolina, Stan points out, notice he used agitated in his report. Sets off alarm in these southern ears. She was agitating. Yeah, you know, you go from agitating in the third degree to uppity in the first degree, and then shit starts going sideways. Well, we were due for one of these. Lee in New York pointing out, stop it, Robin. If they handcuffed her wrists in front of her, she might start knocking again. Good God, not that felonious knocking, please. Anything but that.
Yeah, I know.
Earther, meanwhile, taking the poetic bent. This gets a cowbell. And that is when I heard a gentle rapping on my office door. The lady gave me quite a frightening. There she was, gently tapping on my office door. 'Twas a black legislator, and nothing more. You know, another word for raven is crow. Maybe the crow that was quoting that's name was Jim. Ooh, this might be a hell of a program this evening with wordplay like that. Nope. Dave, number 11, it's not. Good try, though. That's good. Yeah, she might start knocking again. That's rich. Yeah. I think, no, Steve in New York, he said he actually said to her, in the name of the law. Did he? I thought I was making that part up. That was part of the dramatic reenactment. Mm-hmm. And as Ralphs points out, serving as the Horn Ad Hoc Research Department, from the photos, both of the officers dragging her away look pretty skinhead-like. Oh, yeah, they're proud of it. You know, if you just put them in a white T-shirt and jeans, and let's say you got two skinheads, and you got two Georgia State troopers, and you just put them in a white T-shirt and jeans, or preferably prison togs, how would you tell which one was a skinhead and which one wasn't? Ah, it's a trick question. They're all skinheads! Yeah, I did see the actual report. I had to kind of fly through it because this whole thing's kind of on the fly, Steve. No worries. A little bit of research. Jeremy sent this along for Dave and the Blind. From CNN.com, low-income Social Security recipients will get their stimulus payments next week. CNN reporting the Internal Revenue Service will start sending stimulus payments to low-income Social Security recipients this week and expects most of the money to be received electronically on April the 7th. Most eligible households have already received the stimulus payments approved by Congress. Yeah. But Social Security recipients who don't have a 2019 or 2020 tax return on file, typically because their income is below the threshold for filing, are still waiting. The delay affects those who receive Social Security, Supplemental Security Income, or Railroad Retirement Board benefits. That is good and helpful information. Hopefully it'll provide a little bit of solace for a number of people in the Horn Family Community Congregation. Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks. Not exactly, Randy and PA. It's not, but you can be forgiven for thinking that it was. That's close. That was enigmatic, wasn't it? Yeah. Back to our science story. Gas giant, Earther asks. Big and bloated and orange. Trumpanus. New Trumpland. GOP Paradise City. Not a Star Trek V reference, or is it? Take me down to GOP Paradise City where the president's fat and he's got big titties. No. Oh! Shh. We're going to pretend I didn't say that. It's your fault, Earther. You started it. Yeah. What's it? Nope, that's not the... I don't think that's the lyric. No. It's not. But there's... Brother Deacon can try. Don in Prince George, British Columbia says crows and ravens. If someone uses crows, ravens interchangeably, they're wrong. They're very they're a different species. Yeah, but they're... Ah, Don, don't ruin a good bit. That was some intellectual legerdemain. No, crows and rooks and ravens are all different critters. One of them has like little hairs on its beak or something. You know, you can get that taken care of with electrolysis. And it being dark hairs, you can get it taken care of with laser. But never mind. What else? We're getting perilously close. Okay, one more time through. And see, only playing the instrumental intro is the only way I can keep people from Shazamming it. I think. Oh hell! Okay, I'll just give it up. The song is from a Donald Fagen album, because we're close to the top of the hour anyway. It's from a Donald Fagen album. When I said it wasn't as popular as the previous release, this is the Donald Fagen album that followed by something like, God, 9 or 10 years. Donald Fagen's The Nightfly, this album, I remember buying it. I remember listening to it on the car CD player back in the early 90s. The album is called Kamakiriad. And the song that was released as a single is called Tomorrow's Girls. Let's give it a listen. What the hell? Because this is artistic fair use. Chair dancing light is lighted. Lamp is lighted. Well, okay, hang on. I just got a note from Sparky saying, I never heard of Donald Fagen. Well, you've heard Donald Fagen if you've ever heard a Steely Dan song. He's the Dan part, only Don, of Steely Dan. Donald Fagen. No worries, Don. Sorry, says Don. I thought that with Trump gone, the reality spoken here. Well, sure it is, except for artistic plays with literature and metaphor and stuff like that. But yeah, Donald Fagen, half of the team that was Steely Dan. Donald Fagen's still here. Walter Becker is not.
It's just like any other, with citizens that work and play. Normal folks are doing business in the normal way. This morning was like any other. My mistress and daddy's goodbye. Then the milkman screamed and pointed up at the sky. She just to the
Here it is. Yeah. So I went ahead and gave up the lyric that got this whole thing started. Once thought to be only science fiction, astronomers have discovered a planet orbiting a three-star system. And so there it is. In the cool of the evening, in the last light of the triple sun, I wait by the go tree when the day's busy work is done. Soon the warm night breezes start to rollin' in off the sea. Yes, at lantern time, that's when you come to me, come to me, come to me. And, you know, you'd take note of something like that, the cool night breezes from the last light, night of the setting sun, and the warm night breezes when the warm night only happens once every 200 years or so. So that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody was guessing Steely Dan early on. But it wasn't Steely Dan. It's Donald Fagen from the Comicheriod. And, of course, the IAD is a back reference to the Iliad. Hmm? Multiple layers there. And the song itself, if you pull up the lyrics, is a story. Because, you know, from Sheila's to the reefs of Kismar, from Stargate and the Outer Worlds, they're speeding towards our sun on a party run. Here come tomorrow's girls. And, you know, these charming, you know, lyrics that just touch on little aspects of our nature. And but, of course, as is always the case with so many science fiction stories, it has a terrifying ending. This is reminiscent of the C.M. Cornbluth story, To Serve Man, that I think it later became... Yeah, I did. It later became a Twilight Zone episode. And, you know, there's a snap ending there. I don't think I'm ruining this for anybody. I mean, Twilight Zone's been... Yeah. But the Canids show up, and they're really nice to us, and they want us to be happy, and bombs won't go off anymore, and happy little no more warring humans, and they carry what is presumed to be their holy book. And people, well, why are you doing that? Well, our goal is to serve man. And then the skeptical guy at the end finally gets a copy of the book, gets it translated. As people are going up the ramps to the spaceship to go off to the Ganymede planet, he yells, "That book, To Serve Man, it's a cookbook." Well, the same thing happens with this song. You see them on the grass at lunch hour, you know, tomorrow's girls, soaking up the vertical rays in their summer dresses. A little smile can really make your day. Their kisses feel like real kisses. And when they cry real tears. But what's left in your arms when the static clears? And there at the end, they're mixing with the population. A virus wearing pumps and pearls. No, that's not misogynistic. Lord help the lonely guys hooked by those hungry eyes. And it goes on until you finally hear, "Look out, fellas." Then the laugh becomes a furious whine. "Look out, fellas, it's shredding time." Because once again, they're evil aliens bent on human destruction. And naturally, they take female form. Mm-hmm. Well, that was fun, wasn't it? Or was it? I hope it was. Hey, thank you very kindly. Jeremy got us started now that we're into the second hour of the program. Thank you, Jeremy. We are now down at down to 588 and 888. Ooh, triple digits, triple sun. 888 to get finished with the month of March fully funded. Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for getting us started. That is much appreciated. Here's $10 to stop playing Steely Dan. If I never hear it again, then it'll be too soon. But Jeremy, it wasn't Steely Dan. That was Donald Fagen. Not the same thing. That was a solo project. Yeah. But that's the thing. Steely Dan's either love him or hate him. And I'm decidedly in the love him category. Interestingly, Agnes is in the hate him category. But even so, yesterday it was like, oh yeah, that's the theme from A Summer Place. I think I even warned her that it was a Steely Dan clip. She's like, oh, it's okay. We'll sort this out. So here we are in the second hour of the program with oh so much Titanic intellect yet to delve into. Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, and that thing on his head, has decided to try to take on Dr. Fauci again, this time in a tweet. Mm-hmm. Claiming, "Sorry, Dr. Fauci and other fearmongers. New study shows vaccines and naturally acquired immunity do effectively neutralize COVID variants. Good news for everyone but bureaucrats and petty tyrants. Feed 'em!" Okay, I added the feed 'em part. So, it, yeah. He's been after Dr. Fauci for eons now, doing the dirty work of Nitwit Nero, COVID Caligula. Oh, just as a bit of an intermezzo, a quick reminder. Rush Limbaugh, he dead. Okay, just checking. Now, he's been grousing and grumping, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, has. Citing a so-called study published at JAMA Network, the Journal of the American Medical Association Network. And the study that he misunderstands, neutralizing antibodies against SARS-CoV-2 variants after infection and vaccination. This is a multi-author effort. Serum neutralizing antibodies rapidly appear after SARS-CoV-2 infection and vaccination and are maintained for several months. The emergence of SARS-CoV-2 variants has raised concerns about the breadth of neutralizing antibody responses. We compared the neutralizing antibody responses to four variants in infected and vaccinated individuals to determine how mutations within the spike protein are associated with virus neutralization. So here's what they came up with. Basically, they say the study found neutralizing activity of infection and vaccine elicited antibodies against four SARS-CoV-2 variants, including B1, B117, and N501Y. Because neutralization studies measure the ability of antibodies to block virus infection, these results suggest that infection and vaccine-induced immunity may be retained against the B117 variant. As additional variants emerge, neutralizing antibody responses after infection and vaccination should be monitored. Limitations to the study include the small sample size, possible selection bias, lack of clinical outcomes, and how neutralization titers correlate with protection. Not exactly a blanket statement, not exactly what Rand Paul claimed. Namely that new study shows vaccines and naturally acquired immunity do effectively neutralize COVID variants. Good news for everyone, bureaucrats and petty tyrants. And bad news for idiots with dead things on their head. People who were such an asshole, they had to be beaten to teach them some fucking manners and got a lung collapsed and had to go to Canada to get their collapsed lung fixed because Canada has a...
No, I only went to Canada because... I was in a hurry, but they got a communist medical system up there.
Right. Oh, what a fucking idiot. So, Mehul Suthar is one of the authors of that study that I just shared the results with you. And Mehul Suthar said, our interpretation is that our study looks at one aspect of immune response, antibodies. It is not all-encompassing. It is not a blanket statement. But then again, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, I'm socially secure. I'm comfortably well off. Well, he's such a shitty doctor, he had to come up with his own ophthalmologic certifying board. Right. And what they found is that... according to the... We are lucky with B117 that our antibodies appear to work well against this virus within the very narrow and limited and possibly flawed parameters of the study. So, no. Gigi Granvall, a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, said part of the reason that real-world data are so important is looking at the whole picture of immunity. Also, with the level of community transmissions of disease, I would be concerned that there will be more variants that emerge. Gigi Granvall went on to say, in reference to Rand Paul's highly ascientific declaration, blanket assertions made by non-scientific experts are not going to help. Why does that remind me of a line from Monty Python? Strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government either. Right. Yeah. Well, never mind. And then there's Dr. Jesse Goodman, who said it's wrong to declare victory and say there's no problem with variants and that everyone previously infected will be fine. We still do not know. And at this point in time, I think the official number is that, 16% of the population of the United States has been vaccinated. 16%. Maybe I misheard. Maybe it's 60. No, I don't think it is. 16%. But of the people who have been fully vaccinated, maybe that was fully vaccinated. Agnes and I will enter that number day after tomorrow. And remember, just a program note, I don't want it to be this way. I hope it's not this way. There's a possibility that either Thursday or Friday, I'm going to feel like crap and may not be on air. I'm not going to use that as an excuse to take the night off. But if I feel too shitty to crawl behind the microphone, and just, you know, shitty is as shitty does, right? It'll be a game time decision, and I will I'll alert by Twitter and Facebook and Semaphore that I will flag. I probably won't feel like flag waving. I don't know if I'm that bad off. But no, I'll let folks know. But I sure hope it's not. I got to go to the grocery store tomorrow and buy Gatorade, and we're well set with traditional means of hydration, i.e., water. I've become very fond, unpaid product placement, of the Deer Park sparkling water. I've got a bottle of lime in my hand. I worry a little bit about the big buck with his antlers that's on the label, because, you know, only in the last couple of days that we found out there are people out there that collect lion urine. But even among those people who are vaccinated, we still do not know how long immunity lasts. And so, as Dr. Rochelle Walensky pointed out tearfully, as Steve in New York points out, as she noted, this is not the time to say, yay, we're free, and just quit taking precautions. We played that clip is in yesterday's program, if you want to go find it and you missed it. Because, again, as Steve points out, you'll note that cases are no longer going down and are actually on the rise again. Exactly, because, as I said, spring break. Because, come on, we got to go to Padre Island, or come on, we got to go to the Redneck Riviera, or come on, we got to go down to Miami Beach, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's you. Right. So just because you get fully vaccinated does not mean you get to throw your mask away. And look, we've had a year to get used to this. Is it really that much of an inconvenience to keep wearing a mask to finally beat this thing? Because it doesn't seem that way to me. I got myself a couple of really cute masks. One with sort of baby blue sequins, and another one with pink sequins. And yeah, I kind of like them. I think they're a fashion statement. And they're N95s because they've got the N95 insert in there, the filter and everything. And change those frequently and rotate them out. So, right.
But I think we can do this. But then again, I'm talking to the wrong group of people on this. Because this is a community, a family community congregation, that does not refer to them as face diapers. And generally speaking, we're not particularly worried about Jesus not being able to see us behind our masks. But there is, in fact, plenty to worry about. Dr. Goodman, Dr. Jesse Goodman, who was chief scientist at the Food and Drug Administration under the Obama administration, said, "We expect vaccines and prior infection to offer significant protection against variants that are closely related, but as they become more genetically different, like the South African one, that protection could go down. But if people would only cooperate, even if protection went down, we could drastically reduce the number of people who wind up hospitalized and or horizontally crucified." On the other hand, is the European Union overreacting and some of the other nations as well about the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine? Because I think, was it the entire EU? Or maybe it was just Germany? It was in the background. They've called a halt to administering the AstraZeneca vaccine to anyone under 55 because of the blood clot issue, which kind of makes me wonder about what the attitude is toward people 55 and up. Ah, fuck it. Give them the AstraZeneca. They're old. Let them die. I hope that's not it. Today, Jeremy in Vermont points out, we hit 550,000 COVID deaths. Officially, we're still number one. We're still number one. USA! 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 If tomorrow all my friends and family had the coronavirus, I'd still thank God for America. Or whatever Lee Greenweed was warbling. Jesus. Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist. If Rand Paul speaks in a forest and no one is there to hear him, is he still wrong? Well, in point of fact, yes. And the research continues. The Agence France-Presse had a story today. Another study shows that a key player in the immune response called the killer T cell remains mostly unaffected by the variants. Scientists from the National Institutes of Health and Johns Hopkins looked at blood samples, 30 people, and in the Open Forum Infectious Diseases section of the Oxford University Press Journal, they said they wanted to know if the T cells continued to function even in the face of the variants. And the answer appears to be yes. And the killer T cells are important because they look for particular signs of individual cells that have already been infected with pathogens that they've already seen, and recognizing them, they kill those cells. Yeah. So I guess that's kind of some good news. But every piece of good news that comes along still comes with the caveat, we're going to have to keep wearing our masks. We're going to have to keep social distancing. Because the other side of that coin is to watch this thing turn into another goddamn summertime nightmare. Ugh. Maggots. Jeremy also noting that cases are on the rise, particularly in the Northeast. Gee, I wonder if spring breakers would have anything to do with that, Jeremy asking. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's cold. It's still cold up in the Northeast. Spring break comes. You go down to Miami Beach. You LARP and smollock and grabulate and lollygag and spew and spray. And you stand on the street in Miami Beach and get all butthole to belly button with the entire rest of the COVID-spewing world. And then you take it home to Granny there in Battleboro or whatever. Yeah. Because Merca, because Mercan exceptionalism, right? Sure. now, Lee, that's a little too heavy on the self-deprecation. Masks, Lee says, people have been wanting to not see my face for many years. I know, and I've got a face made for radio, but still. Right. Scott in San Diego pointing out, Rand Paul can stand on one foot, cover one eye, turn his head, and cough. P.S. And when he gets a free minute, he can kiss my fat white ass. But only when he gets a minute. Oh, that was quality, Scott. That was good. Yeah. So Rand Paul did not allow his orthopedic surgeon to wear a mask when the surgeon put his broken body back together after Paul's neighbor beat his sorry ass? David in South Carolina, Stan, just asking for a friend. Oh, no, those people have to wear masks because he's Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, and America has to have Rand Paul. Exactly. Matt in San Francisco pointing out, Rand Paul is the equivalent of the bug chasers during the last pandemic. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Ever since Matt informed us about bug chasers, I have remembered, or tried to remember, I think I forgot the term once, but it just reminds you of how bizarre human behavior can be. Oh, well, I'm glad. That's a nice balance to the Steely Dan hatred. Lamar the Magnificent says, I love me some Steely and Donald. Donald Fagen, a black man trapped in a white man's body. I'm a Steely Dan fan from 1973, one of the few white bands that had soul. And I still enjoy my Donald Fagen. I could listen for hours. Try New Frontier. Which is a stunning coincidence because Dave Number 11 sent me. There's this thing it's a thing on YouTube of people making videos of themselves hearing something for the first time. And Dave Number 11 sent me a video earlier today, and it was just a delight to watch. Dude hearing New Frontier by Donald Fagen for the first time. Magic. Just magic. Now, doggone it, Jeremy, you got to be careful with this kind of stuff. Agent Fred, this is strictly speculative, okay? Jeremy asking, better yet, if Rand Paul and his hero neighbor entered a forest together but alone, would Rand come back out? Well, he might come back out. A few more cracked ribs. Yeah. And why are we going to spike again? As Steve in New York points out, well, this is why we're going to spike again. Because we have super geniuses in places like Arlington, Texas. Yeah. The story comes from a little bit earlier this month from Forbes, a real publication. Texas Rangers opening stadium at full capacity shows money was their priority over public safety. Anthony Witrado being the reporter on that story. It wasn't long ago, he writes, about 3 months now, that some Major League Baseball owners were willing to delay the start of the 2021 season for safety concerns because of the pandemic. Then, less than 2 months ago, the Cactus League in several Arizona cities sent a letter to Major League Baseball asking for spring training to be delayed, which would also delay the regular season. Both of the asks would have shortened, and I don't know why we say asks. I hate that. I first encountered it when we started doing work in D.C. Now, you got to make your ask. Ask is a fucking verb. Make your request, make your plea. No, it's an ask now.
Jesus, I'm getting as bad as L'Académie Française. You know, cause,
no. In France, it's not a Big Mac. It's a Royale Grande or something. I don't know. But it would have shortened the regular season. And then, no.
Supposedly, everything was about people's safety, but no. On a Wednesday afternoon earlier in this month, the Texas Rangers said they're going to open Globe Life Field at full capacity on opening day after Texas Governor Greg Abbott said, COVID's so over. We're done with the COVID. In Texas, we got freedom. And, you know, the Attorney General threatened to sue Austin because Austin tried to keep its mask mandate going. But on April the 5th, at that stadium in Arlington, they're going to host a capacity crowd. Yeah. 40,000 people breathing and barking and sneezing and coughing and spraying and spewing all over each other. And it's going to be a good dollar, a big dollar for the Texas Rangers ownership. Yeah. Supposedly, they will require those 40,000 people to all wear a mask, but masking without social distancing or social distancing without masking, you know, faith without works, works without faith, king without a land, the land without a king, not the same. Yeah, it's a Royale with cheese. Okay, that's a quarter pounder. Okay. Thank you, Steve. I knew it was, I was forgetting my dialogue from Pulp Fiction. And you know those Texans ain't going to wear no damn mask, and there's not going to be some usher coming, sir, would you please put your mask on? Fuck you! Bring me a beer! Yeah. So we're going to have another spike, and who knows how awful it's going to get. I'm not trying to be a little ray of sunshine, but I mean, it is what it is. And that's just how it plays out. And so we've reached the halfway point of the program, and I got ahead of myself a little bit. But, Robin! Summer of 42. Oh, when I heard that rock version of Summer of 42 last night, which it wasn't, I immediately recognized that one song, and so did Jeffrey. Jeffrey sings a note. Ah, yes, I remember the Summer of 42, sung by Diana Ross and Percy Faith. Do you know where you're going to? Do you like the things that you... No, Jeffrey, you're confused again. I know. I was just doing my own version of a mix down featuring the Summer of 42 and Diana Ross's theme from... Wait for it. Yes, the mix there, Summer of 42 and Diana Ross, the theme from Monogamy, written and also often performed by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir because they've always believed in one man and one dozen women. Okay. Yeah, that was so not necessary, Jeffrey, really. Yes, I remember that song, The Summer of 42, because as a young Joey, about 9 years... Joey, it's not the summer of 42, buddy. Oh, that's okay. About 9 years old, my mother bought me that album, and I really thought that was a great song. However, I didn't see the movie in the theater, but rather a couple of years later on Tuesday Night Movie of the Week, I really understood that movie and could really relate to those three horny guys chasing those girls all over the beach that summer. So when you played that rock version, that Steely Dan version of the Summer of 42, I instantly recognized the song, and it brought back a lot of memories listening to the Percy Faith album play on the old record player. It immediately reminded me of the rock version of Frank Sinatra's song, I Did It My Way, from the movie Goodfellas. About a year later, in 1974, I saw the movie The Way We Were, as Rick mentioned, the theme song as a guest to the mystery song last night. I really didn't understand The Way We Were that much as a 12-year-old, but watching the movie 45 years later, I could really relate to Barbara Streisand trying to save democracy in the 40s and 50s, while an arrogant Robert Redford, her husband, Hubble,
in the movie was a total egotistical right-winger who had no regard for her political feelings or liberal-thinking people. As a 12-year-old, that movie had little meaning to me, but many years later, that movie has all the meaning in the world, and I can truly relate to the sentiments of that film nowadays. With all that's going on in Georgia and around the country right now, with all these voter suppression tactics and legislation, I really don't think I could watch The Way We Were and not just break down crying. If we don't pass the People's Act, democracy may be over in this country. You know, interestingly, democracy was already over when we finally got around to passing the Voting Rights Act, and it was the gutting of the Voting Rights Act that led to all these voter suppression bills, such as what's going on in Georgia. It, never mind, that's me. I'm editorializing on Joey's conversation here. Jeffrey has a political metaphor. I will not attempt any pun humor in my next statement, but metaphorically speaking, I believe that cargo carrier in the Panama Canal should have been named Democracy, because I think it symbolized where democracy may be in this country right now, and that is stuck in muck and mire of the radical right. Yes, the good ship Democracy was stuck in the sewage canal this weekend and needed to be rescued. Well, right now our democracy is being tossed in the garbage by Republicans, and we good liberals need to go and rescue the rights of voters, as today is the 151st anniversary of the 15th Amendment was formally adopted, which declared that the right of U.S. citizens to vote could not be abridged or denied by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. How ironic! Jeffrey continues. On this day in 1867, William H. Seward signed a treaty with Russia to purchase Alaska for $7 million. Despite the bargain price of roughly 2 cents an acre, hell, Jefferson paid 3 cents for the Louisiana purchase. The Alaskan purchase was ridiculed in Congress, and the press labeled it Seward's folly. And if we don't get this country back on track and allow the 15th Amendment to continue to stand, we may have our own folly and a falling from democracy. Good job, Jeffrey. I'm proud of you. That was a nice departure for you. Ironically, the summer of 42 ended with an interesting twist, being a native of Northeast Ohio, as Joey is. As many know, summer of 42 ended with Dorothy receiving a telegram from the Scarecrow. With Dorothy receiving a telegram that her husband's plane was shot down over France and he had perished in the plane crash. A distraught Dorothy decides to grant Hermie his wish and makes love to him at the cottage home near the beach. The movie ends with Dorothy leaving the island and going home and never to be heard from again. Keep in mind, this was based on a true story. Jeffrey wraps things up. About 13 years after the movie and over 40 years after the rendezvous of Hermie and Dorothy, Hermie receives a letter in the mail from Dorothy. Initially, Hermie does not take it seriously until he reads the letter and realizes that it had to be Dorothy because she laid out facts. Oh, Jeffrey. That only the real Dorothy would have known. Dorothy did not want any money or any royalties from the movie and book, but just to let Hermie know that she was doing well and wished the same for him. There was no return address except for one clue as to the whereabouts of Dorothy, and that was the postmark on the envelope, which was from nearby where Joey grew up. So, yes, the envelope was postmarked from Canton, Ohio. This has been Joey's Journal for Titanic Tuesday, the 30th of March, 2021, with Giraffe steering the good ship Democracy back on course. And there's a $10 challenge that will be greatly helpful. That would get us down to, it would get us down to $568. And $868 to finish March. We got, and I think we better just use that number because otherwise it's going to be ugly. We got $868 to go to finish fundraising for the month of March, and every penny of it is necessary. Thank you, Joey. Thank you, Giraffe. But guys, please, it was not the summer of 42. It was the theme from a summer place. Come on. Get with the game. I mean, I gave the answer. I really did. Nonetheless, that was a nice little departure on the part of Joey and Giraffe. But it just the departure started from a. It was the theme from a summer place. Come on. Yeah, lion urine, Kevin in Colorado Spring asks. I just got back from my second COVID-19 vaccine. I tuned in just about the time you mentioned someone collecting lion urine. Pray tell, what maggot is collecting lion urine and why? Signed, Kevin in Colorado Springs, still wearing a mask whenever I'm around anyone, vaccinated or not. Smart man, Kevin. Smart man. Let me just suggest you go back in a podcast or two to sort that out. Lion urine has apparently remarkable properties for keeping something away. Right. Steely Dan and my diminished powers. Billable Rick says, I saw Steely Dan, or should I say surviving member Donald Fagen, at the Classic West Supergroup shows at Dodger Stadium in July 2017, and Donald Fagen still lives. Since we said goodbye to Tom Petty, my power over aging rock stars is clearly diminishing. Good for them and good for me. Yeah, but when did Walter Becker pass away, Billable? Don't be thinking your powers are flagging. They may not be. No. Oh, and remember when we found out a couple of months back about Enrique Tarrio being a snitch for the feds? And his immediate response was, no, I wasn't no snitch. I don't want to be found face down in a ditch. That's Jeffrey Worthy. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out the federal government was playing footsie with another proud boy. Uh-huh. The LA Times with a report today about Joseph Biggs, whom the FBI recruited. And I think there probably needs to be a congressional investigation of this, at least in the House. It's still kind of hard to get much done in the Senate, but this we need some investigating on this. Why was the FBI recruiting a member of the Proud Boys to be an informant about the activities of Antifa? Anybody? Any kind of an answer? Bueller? No, this Biggs creep, Joseph Biggs, was supposed to provide the FBI with information about Antifa activists in Florida. It was late July of last year when the FBI contacted him, according to J. Daniel Hull, who is his lawyer, who included that information in a court filing. And in the Times article, it says that lawyer Hull's claims buttress a widely held view among left-leaning ideological opponents of the Proud Boys, that law enforcement has coddled them, condoned their violence, and even protected them during their frequent street brawls with anti-fascists. And again, as we pointed out yesterday evening, of course, Antifa only shows up after the fascists do. Which is kind of indicative, you know, of the fact that Antifa are not the problem. But nonetheless, as the LA Times reports, the FBI reached out to a group of fascists who would go on to participate in an attack on the capital of the United States of America.
Hey, can you give us some information on Antifa? Yeah.
And this Joseph Biggs guy, and this is the funniest thing that's happened all evening on this program. Joseph Biggs is described as a thought leader. A thought leader for the Proud Boys. An agent contacted Biggs, according to his lawyer, and set up a meeting in late July 2020 to meet at a restaurant. And they asked Biggs who he was seeing on the ground. And an agent followed up with a series of questions and phone calls to Biggs about who they were seeing. Lawyer Hull said, they spoke often. And this is all put forward in an effort to keep Joe Biggs out of the stir because, well, I guess he's been arrested for some sort of relationship, perhaps to the attack on the Capitol. Yeah. Yeah. In the brief by Lawyer Hull, Pettifogger Hull,
these talks were intended both to inform law enforcement about Proud Boy activities in Portland on a courtesy basis, but also to ask for advice on planned marches or demonstrations, i.e. what march routes to take on Portland streets, where to go, where not to go.
Even though, once again, Antifa only showed up when these little fascist bully boys showed up. Because the cost of not opposing fascists is that you wind up with what? Yes, attacks on the Capitol of the United States in January 6, 2021. Mm-hmm. Took a while, but even the FBI director, Christopher Wray, said, nah, Antifa didn't have a goddamn thing to do. With the attack of January 6th. But this is kind of a reminder, just like the fuck-uppery in the Social Security Administration and the fuck-uppery in the Postal Service, of what happens when miserable, shit-eating, weasel fascists squirm and crawl and belly squirm into the bowels of a traditional liberal democracy-driven republic. Can we put it that way? Yeah. And so the same FBI director whose agent was out there playing footsie with a fascist is still in charge of the FBI. So maybe, I don't know, maybe Senator Sheldon Whitehouse can add some questions for Christopher Wray about this little bit of dumbass skullduggery. I mean, what? Did he think Joe Biggs was on the inside of Antifa? Or that they knew each other on site? And maybe, you know, maybe it was like after the 2004 presidential election when John Kerry went skiing with Arnold Schwarzenegger because they're all friends, even though they're Republicans and Democrats, and that's what it's like with Antifa and the Proud Boys. They like each other. You know, they just hate each other when they're on the playing field together. You know, it's like the Browns and the Steelers or something, right? Or the Bears and the Packers. No. But the FBI was particularly focused on people who self-identified as members of Antifa. You know, at the same time that the Proud Boys were beating the living shit out of anybody they could lay hands on. Yeah, precisely. So that. Hey, Samson, thanks a ton. That's tremendous. We just took a bite out of the 888. We're down to 788 now. That's huge. We came into these last 3 days of March at a little over $1,000 to go, and we're down to 788 to finish March in good form. I cannot thank you enough, Samson. Thank you. So 788. If we could get down, we could get $488 more, we would be able to go into tomorrow to the good. And in point of fact, I just forgot something. I saw it yesterday, and it's not 788, because I forgot that our pal Stockton Larry did have a show on me for the last day of the broadcast month. So pardon my mistake. It is not 788. It is 488. Thank you. Thank you very kindly. And thanks as well. Thank you, Samson. Thank you so very much. That is so. 488, and we're done with March. Awesome. Awesome. Cowbell for Joey, sewage canal instead of Suez Canal. I'll honor that request, Billable. And how about that? Dave number 11 says, not to make it about me, but the summer of 42 was filmed less than a mile from where I grew up. They built the beach house on my grandparents' property and then burned it to the ground when filming was finished. Son of a gun. They could have at least left the beach house. Well, maybe your grandparents didn't want it. So, wavelength between me and Giraffe. Cool. Thanks, Dave. I love these little connective tissue kind of moments. Rusty says, Antifa HQ is just down the road from the clean coal plant. Oh, yeah, okay. Okay, Rusty. Yeah, that gets it. Mm-hmm. Just down the road from the clean coal plant. Because, you know, clean coal plants don't exist, and neither does Antifa HQ, because there's no H to Q. Q? No, please, no. No, just no. And Darlene in Connecticut just sent this along, and I find this delightful and interesting, and hope it comes to, let's just say I hope it doesn't hurt too little. Headline from Axios's Jonathan Swan. I like it when he shows up on my filthy morning habit, because, you know, he's got that nice Australian accent. Over here taking some hard-working American's journalism job. That's what he's doing. Taking a hard-working American journalism job, Jonathan Swan. Need to build a wall around the Pacific Ocean to keep them Australians out of America, take American jobs. No, Matt Getz says that, described by Jonathan Swan as a rising star conservative firebrand. Really? Not a floating turd conservative firebrand, Jonathan? Really? But he told Axios that he's under investigation for sexual activity with women and fears being criminally charged. Hold on. Hold on. Nobody gets investigated for sexual activity. What you get investigated for is sexual abuse and sexual assault. Consensual sexual activity is still quite legal in this country. Mm-hmm. Matt Getz said, and based on the fact, I guess Axios reached out to him because it's going around in D.C. that he's told people close to him that he's thinking about not seeking re-election and maybe even leaving Congress early for a job at Newsmuck. Damn, Newsmuck must be paying real good. But he gave a quote to Axios and said, "The allegations against me are as searing as they are false. I believe that there are people at the Department of Justice who are trying to criminalize my sexual conduct, you know, when I was a single guy." Is that a misprint? Is that a typo? You know, when I was before I was a sober guy. Mm-hmm. Says he's been told very little about the allegations. But as of yesterday afternoon, the Justice Department says they're investigating him over whether he had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old and paid for her to travel with him. And according to Matt Getz, who of course is a serial liar, "The allegations of sexual misconduct against me are false. They are rooted in an extortion effort against my family for $25 million in exchange for making this case go away." No. Settlement negotiations in a civil case are not necessarily an extortion. But Jonathan Swan, then interpreting the sound of Matt Getz's voice, said, "Sounding shaken, Getz said that for weeks he and his father had been working with the FBI in the Northern District of Florida on the extortion case. Getz said his lawyers were informed by the Justice Department that I was not a target but a subject of an investigation regarding sexual conduct with women." Really? You believe that? I mean, I know we just had a story about the FBI playing footsie with Antifa, sure. But the FBI shows up on your door and says, "Congressman Getz, we'd like to talk to you about the fact that you have sex with women." I mean, lying to the FBI is still a crime, of course. But really? I mean, go look up a picture of Matt Getz. I mean, I know on this planet there's somebody for everybody. Mostly. But really? Sex with Matt Getz? How would either a boy or a girl quit vomiting long enough to do that? Jesus, the liquor breath coming off of Matt Getz would drop a fucking buzzard at 40 paces. "I have definitely, in my single days, provided for women I've dated. You know, I paid for flights, for hotel rooms, left money on nightstands." No, I added that part. "I've been, you know, generous as a partner. I think someone's trying to make that look criminal when it's not. I'm absolutely confident none of the women were underage." Yeah. Because, you know, you can just get the, you can just tell their age by a good, long, longing glance. Is that it, Matt? Is that what it is? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, oh, golly. You know, what's curious is that he's not under investigation, or maybe he is, I don't know. I'd like to think so. For any particular role that he may have had in, say, the attack on the Capitol of the United States of January 6th and the planning, therefore, in the days leading up. Could that be it? Well, thank you for that, Matt, in San Francisco. Getz sex, which is funny all by itself because everybody... No. Then again, if you take a good look at Matt Getz, you realize he probably does have to pay for sex. It's true. Takes all kinds. As Matt points out, some people are into cartoon bubblehead-looking dudes. Yeah. Still. I mean, I guess I've just ruined dinner in the Central Daylight Time Zone, and early diners in the Pacific Daylight Time Zone are probably having a hard time with their microwave Salisbury steak, too. Steve in New York points out, "Matt Getz, he's a pig seeking sex with human women. I do think bestiality is still illegal." Mm-hmm. "I'm going to leave early and take a job with Newsmuck." What, Onan wouldn't hire you? Oh, no, they've already got Seb Gorka. Oh, God, Jeremy. Really? Okay. Back to the summer of 42. Jeremy asks, "Well, how about the summer of 69 when I got my first real six string? I bought it at the Five and Dime and played it till my fingers bled." I don't know about this 42 stuff. Well, yeah, 42 is the answer to life, the universe, and everything. We know that. Who doesn't know that? I wonder if summer of 42 inspired Douglas Adams to choose 42. Oh, we'll never know. But I saw that headline, Matt Getz under federal investigation, and I thought, aha! They're finally moving in on the plotters and schemers and conspirators of January the 6th, but no. Matt Getz being... He's had a rough time, Matt Getz has. I mean, when you're getting gender punked by Liz Cheney, who looks like her dad in a bad wig, frankly, for bragging about doing your own makeup on Fox. Ugh. You have any idea how difficult eye makeup is? It's brutal. I tell you, it's brutal. And Stockton Larry in the chat room reminding us of an oldie but a goodie from Roll Call. Namely, 404, sorry, we can't find it, but the title says it all. Matt Gaetz and the until now unknown adopted son from Cuba. Not that there's anything wrong with, never mind. This is Stockton Larry.
Yeah, that's good.
I told you there was a bunch. Let's see. Scott, somebody's already on the Skype line. Try the stress line. Scott in San Diego. And so, at the beginning of the third hour, 488 to go. If we get 188 bucks in, that means we've only got the regular three. Or if we just knocked it out, we could have, if somehow or another, we could have a little miracle in the next hour. We could knock, have fundraising free radio for the final day of March 2021, and that would be lovely too. But taking a bite out of that would be great. It'd be wonderful to pay a bill this evening. Okay, let's run over and check in with Rick. Hey, Rick.
Can you hear me?
I do.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you? How's Spock?
No, he's good, lounging up there judging my strategy on the latest video game hole I fell into.
New one, is it?
I got a game called Solaris. It's basically chess, but for when chess isn't masochistic enough for you.
Fun.
Yeah,
Are there whips and chains and gimp masks involved or something? I don't know.
Damn near. It's basically a strategy game where it spawns a galaxy with up to, like, depending on the size, from 6 to 1,400 planets. And you're basically playing the game to try to build your empire and outlast the other ones. You can either do it through violence or diplomacy. It's really your choice. But I found a Star Trek mod for it, and I've been playing as the Klingons.
It's always fun to be a Klingon. Nice big bowl of gawk like Mama used to make.
I've always wondered what that tastes like. You know what that stuff actually was?
Klingon bloodworms, I think.
Yeah, but what they were actually eating on the show, they basically took a fishing lure, cast it inside of a silicon mold. One of the ones that doesn't have the smell on it, and then they used that to cast basically gummy worms. They were literally eating bowls of gummy worms covered in some kind of syrup to make it look like blood.
Oh, you
Jonathan Frakes said if he ever had to eat another bowl of it, he was going to become a diabetic.
That sounds pretty disgusting.
Yeah. At least they didn't make them try to eat fishing lures or something. You know, cost-cutting measures.
No, you know, around here, it's not at all unusual to see signs outside convenience stores, night crawlers for sale.
Yeah, go the all-natural route.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got a substantial, you know, organic, you know, because this is a kind of a hip little tourist area and everything, so we've got a substantial organic component, and you know, you don't want the fish you catch to have to eat, you know, like genetically modified artificial lures.
Yeah, the three-eyed fish from The Simpsons.
Yeah, those things have been found in the Coal River.
Yeah, I just
downstream from mountaintop removal operations.
Yeah, next thing you know, they'll be finding basically buffalo wings growing off a chicken. The old joke about remember the Buffalo Wild Wings commercial with Jessica Simpson?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's that, except they're actual, like, chicken wings sticking out of the side of a fish. All of a sudden, the fish will start flying out of the lake.
Right.
You know, apparently we've skipped straight past the pigs flying and skipped straight to the goodbye and thanks for all the fish point of the evening.
Exactly. And by the way, Jeremy in Vermont had a note for you. Yeah, what you're talking about, it's the game Civilization, only larger and in space.
Yeah, basically. And I have a mod for it that, as I said, changed over Star Trek, but I've also been playing as a Terran Empire recently. Sometimes I like to be the bad guy. Well, about halfway through my
The Earthlings
play,
are the bad guys?
The Terran Empire, yeah.
Well, yeah, sure. Okay, right, yeah.
In the mod, it adds in both the mirror and the regular versions of each empire. It's kind of an interesting mod, really, and a lot of work's gone into it. It's very well done. But, yeah, I just wanted to call in and see how you were doing. Oh, on the note of random facts and Star Trek, obligatory Star Trek mention of secondary mention of the evening, I guess. Did you know they've started making Klingon opera?
No, but the screaming would be delightful, I'm sure.
It's actually in Klingon. The Klingon language.
No, I know it exists. It's a tongue. Yeah. I think you can even get credit hours in it at a couple of universities out there somewhere.
This is apocryphal, and I heard it from a guy in the army who served as one of the army posted guards at the UN. And I don't know if it's true or if he was just pulling my leg because I'm a Star Trek fan, but because more than 4% of the human, there are more people in the world that are fluent in Klingon than are fluent in any other fictional made-up language, and there's so many of them, it's considered a world language now, which means they have to have a translator.
No. That's got to be urban legend. Nope.
I'm believing it is, but it would be... It still tickles that part of my brain and makes me laugh a little bit that there's some dude there, just in case someone who shows up who only speaks Klingon.
If that was the case, I would have to throw a fit. Because there are so many endangered languages on this planet. There are so many that have already gone extinct. It's heartbreaking because it's one of those cases of not knowing what you don't know. We don't know what we lost.
Yeah.
There are extant, there are over a million speakers of Nahat in, because I can't make that glottal L thing with the T-L. I just can't. But it's spelled N-A-H-A-U-T-L. There's over a million native speakers of that remaining in Mexico who speak that and not Spanish. Not that white Merca knows anything about that. They're beautiful, complex languages. Otomi in Mexico is a brilliant tongue. Quiche, I think that's a Mayan tongue. It's still extant. And then, of course, there are my friends up in the Northwoods who still speak Anishinaabemowin, which is the Ojibwe tongue. And there are thousands of people who speak that.
One thing I thought was kind of interesting is the guy who basically created the Klingon language was basically just – they paid him $50 to write like 5 lines of Klingon. He came back. They ended up finding the one autistic dude at the entire fucking college that works in the linguistics department and gave him the job. And this guy comes back 3 days later with 3 library wagons full of information he had basically obsessively written over the last 6 months. Language, grammar, syntax, everything that makes a language he had within 6 months of them requesting it.
Well, look at Tolkien's creation of like 2 or 3 different Elvish languages, and then of course there was the speech of Mordor. But yeah,
one thing that's interesting about it is the fact that, you know, how they've been trying to create a universal language that everybody seems to be equally able to learn for years to replace English as a trade language. Like they tried Esperanto for a while, I believe.
I mean, I know those experiments have taken place, but it has to be organic.
Yeah, and that's the thing. This isn't organic thing. It wasn't planned. But something about the way that this guy structured the Klingon language makes it very easy for people to learn once they get the hang of the syntax. And it would be very funny for me as the little anthropologist inside of me that they tried to do this for years with an artificial language, and then someone creates an artificial language, and it organically turns into a universal language that's bridging countries. There was some peace treaty in the Middle East that was
I thought that was mathematics.
I'm talking about, like, non-mathematical languages.
Or wait, I thought music was the universal language. Wait, that's mathematical.
Yeah. I'm talking more linguistical communication. Because the guy went so far as it has words in Klingon that we don't have in English. They're pulled from reference words to other languages, so it's ironically a very good bridge language. Be kind of ironic in like 700 years everyone on Earth is speaking Klingon.
Yeah, let's hope that doesn't happen.
You know what they say, tell your wife you love her, but yell it at her in Klingon because life is frightening.
That's good. Yeah, I've seen that. How romantic. If languages really do interest you, Rick, you should look into some of these endangered indigenous languages. I think, and you know, I know you know who Noam Chomsky is. You know, his original field of expertise is linguistics.
Yeah, it's interesting that a lot of the socialist members of economics started out in either linguistics or anthropology as their original base.
That doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me in the least, really, when you consider.
Well, they work on the ground level with people, so they see all of this shit that's normally not exposed to most people.
Well, and not just that. It's the fact that anthropology tends to try to reductively explain, you know, how we got to where we are from where we were, and so looks at preconceived notions about human nature that is theoretically derived, and the next thing you know, you're talking about, you know, how, and one of my favorite topics is the question of whether the move to sedentary agriculture was really a good idea for humanity, because there's an argument to be made, a strong argument, that it wasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I know everybody likes Frisbees and Wheat Chex, but
individually.
You know, evolution does not have a positive or negative bias.
Yeah.
It's a matter of success or unsuccess. And as such, humanity thus far can be said to have been vastly more successful as hunter-gatherers than we have been in the 7,000 years or so that we've been doing sedentary agriculture.
The way I kind of look at it is this might be the – I think we as a species are at an inflection point. We're at the point during the forging process where you either make or break the blade.
Well, see, I would take issue with that. I think we passed that point a long time ago. Because the blade's long since broken. And it can't be hastily re-glued. We fucked up. We fucked up bad. Because humanity stands on the brink of something approaching an extinction-level event. And it's because of what we've done. I mean, resource depletion, environmental catastrophe have all happened all over the planet. The Mayans fucked themselves right out of their empires because they deforested. I mean, if you look now, you know, Central America looks like, you know, one great big forest. But yeah. It takes time for that to come back, and they so thoroughly deforested themselves over the course of about 750,000 years that the civilizations could no longer be sustained. The same thing with the Anasazi culture in the southwest United States. Brilliant at one time, but you can't cut down all the trees. But they did. So that's where that's where that kind of calculus comes in. You know, to what degree do we do civilizations rising and falling come into play? The Romans got hold of, well, the Carthaginians had the Iberian Peninsula, and the Romans took it from them and began exploiting the silver resources. The Carthaginians had been as well, but not on the level or degree that the Romans did. And to this day, the Iberian Peninsula bears the scars of massive deforestation. The entire British island, you know, from Wales up through Scotland, was completely deforested, pretty much for lumber and heat, and likely would have collapsed like the Mayan civilization did had they not discovered coal.
True. And one thing that was a random fact, since we're talking about history, and this is just a side note popped into my head when you were talking about the silver. Back during the Viking Age, silver was the predominant currency because it was the most plentiful and most commonly used, and pretty much everyone accepted silver. It was the Visa of their day, and the Vikings stole so much of it, it forced change over to gold currency throughout Northern Europe because there was so little silver because it was all inside the Viking treasure holds.
The same thing would happen in the 16th century. Well, what century are you talking about?
Right after from the sacking of Lindisfarne until the Anglo-Saxon occupation of England?
No, I don't think so, because gold was the most precious currency. Silver was by far the most available, but hell, the Romans went down into bronze, but
yeah,
talents. The most highly valued currency was gold in the Roman Empire.
Yeah, I'm talking more about early medieval England after the fall of the Roman Empire. A lot of the smaller empires that came out of it couldn't do the massive coinage systems the Romans had, the mint system. A lot of them would just pressure coins, and that's where we actually get the term quarter from. The term quarter actually comes because most of those silver coins, because they were soft, had a cross marked in them, and you would use a chisel and literally quarter your silver piece. And that was, as you said, the most ubiquitous currency, and most places would accept it. Most gold was actually traded between the empires themselves. Unless you were rich, the average person probably never saw a gold piece in their life. But what I'm talking about is England, France, what eventually became France and Germany, all switched over to different currencies besides silver, predominantly with smaller units of gold coin, because there was so little silver because Vikings were stealing it all. They were pulling it out of circulation and using it and trading it amongst themselves.
Well, like I said, by the 16th century, or no later than the 17th, the Spanish primarily, the Portuguese to a certain extent, but the Spanish primarily, by virtue of their colonial thefts, amassed such wealth in silver that they eventually, because they didn't really understand economics the way we do, they collapsed their own fucking currency by flooding the market with pieces of eight. The Spanish doubloon was probably the dominant, one of the dominant currencies in the early United States.
And that was actually a long-term fluctuation caused by that silver drought throughout the late Middle Ages. Early Middle Ages, because of the Vikings. That's the reason why the doubloon and other gold pieces, because gold was the reason gold became so highly valued as and coinage as a major trade currency is because there was nothing else. Silver was just pulled out of the market, and after people switched over, then silver became a secondary currency. Even after it went back into the market, if that makes sense.
Sure. No, and I'm getting some pushback from Greg saying, oh, how the fuck do you know they cut down all the trees? Indians were and are stewards of nature. Damn white man's anthropology. Grr. We didn't come over on a fucking land bridge either, else we wouldn't have rode, we would have rode horses and not walked. Duh. LMAO. Well, the earth does not lie. The earth keeps the earth will tell on you in terms of everything you do. And it's not white man's anthropology or anybody else's anthropology. It's fucking soil science. And one of the
other things we talked about last time I talked, economics. We're actually seeing in real time right now. Remember what I mentioned about the fact that were you the one I talked about where coming off the gold standard basically gave us the infinite money cheat for governments?
I don't think so. That doesn't sound like me.
Okay. Basically, because most economics we still have today, Republican economics, is based in ideas that were put out in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Oh, earlier than that. Earlier than that. Mercantilism, zero-sum game economics, the idea that that wealth was decidedly finite, and that if you had more, somebody had to have less. Yeah.
Yeah, all of that is based off of the gold and silver standard because of the fact that every time that you print a dollar bill, you're subdividing that base currency more. That was the reason that they took us off of it, because we couldn't continue growing the American empire if we stayed on gold standard, because we keep subdividing the money and cause inflation. If you don't have anything backing your money besides fiat, the fiat of the currency itself, which is what we use now, you end up with a situation where there's inflation only exists if they see you putting the money in the market. If you carry the money out in duffel bags and put it into the market and no one knows it's there, no one cares. The moment you tell people about it, because of the old economics of the zero-sum game mentality that's been bred into America, it actually affects the psychology of the money once they find out the money's out there, and then it affects the market.
Okay. I'm not an economist. It is called the dismal science, and I believe that for a reason.
I fell into a rabbit hole. I read a bunch, starting with Das Kapital, and it just went from there.
Well, Marx is as much social commentary as it is economic.
Yeah. So I started reading for the social commentary for my humanities class, and then it went from there. I think I have every major work by anyone who follow. I'm probably on some kind of list now because I bought all these books in conjunction. But the ones like Marx and all of the different people who followed Marx, with the exception of the communists, don't really think Lenin has much to offer that's of great use. Does that make sense?
Yeah, to an extent. By the way, Earther pointed out, my dad is an anthropologist and my mom is a linguist. Both socialists and Marxists for a while, but my dad is no longer. Not quite sure what that means. Earther, I'm not sure that... I don't know if you mean that... Well, we will optimistically assume that Earther's dad is no longer... And I don't mean it's optimism that he would have gone away from being a socialist and a Marxist, but that, not that he is no longer with us, but that he is just no longer of that particular philosophy. Oh, and by the way, I need to get a message to Scott in San Diego. Like I said, the Skype line is in use. If you want to get in queue, Scott, use the stress line. That's 844-843-4676, 844 the horn. I think Scott was trying to get in on the other line, the 304-574-8178, but that rings into the same line you're on, right? Yeah.
Okay. The thing that's bedeviling us economically right now is the zero-sum game mentality. As long as that continues to persist as an economic driver, then the actual full potential of the fiat currency we use in the United States is being held back by economic ideas. This would be like complaining about the using jet engines because we still have the wheel. if that makes sense.
Yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, sure.
And that's what's holding us back, because it's all of these older, more conservative, zero-sum economic individuals who are the ones who freak out when they find out money's been put into the economy. They cause a stink. That stink then causes apprehension. That apprehension causes inflation. If they never know the money's there, like if you're just walking out and just dropping, like the IRS is just dropping the bags of money on the street and no one knows where it's coming from, it never affects the market at all. The value never goes, the dollar never goes down, and inflation never goes up. It's entirely psychosomatic, caused by greed.
Greed does a lot of bad things.
And, well, that's all I had. That was my rant for the evening. I hope it was enlightening. I know it was a little tangential.
No, not at all. Don't worry about that in the least. And given the way that you learn, do yourself a favor. Go out and learn a little bit about the really endangered languages.
I actually really enjoy reading about those civilizations. I can't learn a new language to save my life. My brain is built. I'm basically data off Star Trek. I can figure out the computer language of any computer you put me in front of if you give me enough time with it. But if you try to teach me another language, you might as well just jump off a cliff, because it'll be quicker.
Well, it's just
going to be a slow death by a thousand cuts trying to teach me any language.
Well, it's still worth learning about the cultures, because they are brilliant.
And they came
very close to being absolutely erased. I mean, you want to talk about a fascination with language? The Peruvian and the Andean cultures that gave us the quipu remain one of the most fascinating topics I've ever run across. Because we know,
for me,
go ahead.
Two of my favorite places of fascination are the country of Punt, I think it's called. The Egyptians mentioned it. A bunch of other cultures mentioned it. Never bothered writing down the directions, because everyone knew where the fuck it was, and then it died, and now no one knows where the fuck it was.
Well, just to finish that thought, do you know what a quipu is?
Not entirely.
It was thought to be similar to an abacus. It was thought to be an accounting method that relied upon fiber strands and the way that knots were tied in the strands.
It was a knot writing technique, right?
There are very few extant examples of it anymore, because Roman Catholic priests thinking that there are demons involved, because there are demons everywhere. God damn it! But it turns out that it turns out, Rick, that these quipus used both location of the knots, how the knots were oriented, how the knots were tied, what the distance was between the knots, and what color the threads were.
So it was basically an early form of Braille in a manner of looking at it.
Well, yeah, kind of, but much, much more expressive. Because one of the most fascinating things about the Andean cultures and the coastal cultures is that they were brilliant textilists. Not textualists, but textilists. Makers
of
textiles.
They made some of the finest cloth in the world.
Because they domesticated cotton early on and did amazing things with it.
And like the other culture I'm fascinated with is the Sumerians.
There's a great example of a culture that fucked itself pretty quickly. All of those Mesopotamian cultures, built these magnificent edifices, the ziggurats at Ur and Akkad, and, your Gilgamesh and your Tilgath-Pileser III and whatnot. And they did so by developing, shortly after sedentary agriculture came along, which is where you get the idea, where the concept of poor people comes from, because a sedentary agricultural society has to have poor people, because you have to keep them poor and scared to keep them feeding people who don't work. Chieftains, priests, priestesses, whatnot. But when they developed sedentary agriculture, they came to a fairly quick realization that you gotta have water to grow shit. And anybody who's ever seen Idiocracy knows that you cannot water your crops with Brondo. It's got what plants crave.
Ironically, I'm hydrating myself with Brondo right now.
Well, and see, the thing is, those are electrolyte solutions. And part of the brilliance of Mike Judge is that tucked away inside the concept of Brondo is the real-world story of what happened to early societies with irrigation. Because no matter how pure you think the water is with which you are irrigating your crops, and this applies to... No, this applies to this very day. You will salinate your ground. Salination is the great foe of irrigation. And so when you irrigate, eventually you will stop being able to grow things in the irrigated soil. It's just a fact of life on planet Earth.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first, so you have to keep, keep opening new areas to irrigation, and then it salinates and it won't grow shit. And the next thing you know, you started with a big ass, not particularly well watered area, and you wind up with a great big ass, no kidding, fucking drier than a snake's belly in a wagon rut desert.
True. And the thing that just got me was how quickly it faded.
Oh, those things rose and fell, but quick is a relative term in those instances, because look at the United States of America. We are what? 234 years old, if you count from the ratification of the Constitution. And we, much more of this January 6th horse shit, and this country will literally be a flash in the pan. And I know you know where that term comes from.
Yes. It's a kick and no pop.
Yeah.
And no kick.
And there's another, I love it when people take me down these little literary digressions. You ever read Joseph Heller's Catch 22?
No, I haven't.
Put it on your list, Rick.
I've got the movie version.
No, no, no.
I know the new movie is never as good as the book.
It can't contain the information. There is a brilliant scene that takes place inside an apartment in Rome with an old Italian man of indeterminate ancientness, and he delivers a monologue on civilization that is unequaled. I've never seen anything even touch it. So by all,
by the way, Spock says hi. He just plotted the microphone.
Oh, very nice. Hi, Spock. I don't let little Lucy Purr Morning Paw back here, because she would probably take the program off the air.
I got lucky. He's a smart kitty, so he doesn't bite any of my cables or mess with anything. He went to bite one of them once, and he saw the look of horror on my face and realized how much my computer meant to me. He hasn't touched it since.
Oh, good boy, Spock. Good boy. Well, Rick, you have yourself a good evening. I'm gonna check in here. Scott apparently wanted in too, so. We'll see what he's got to say.
To say it's but get probably time for
own
me to...
it. If you don't, it is time for you to own a copy of Catch 22. Plus, you will laugh your happy ass off through it. There are moments.
It's military humor, from my understanding.
Well, it's humanistic humor that happens to have a military backdrop.
Okay, well, I love that sort of stuff. So, do they have it in an audiobook?
I imagine it might exist as one. I can't imagine consuming Catch 22 in anything but printed form, because you've got to see the formatting. You can't get that out of audio because it is not linear. And I don't know if Joseph Heller is regarded in this sense, but for me, It was my first couple of times through Catch-22, and I can't tell you the number of times I've read it. I reread books like people rewatch movies.
Fair enough.
I'm in the middle of rereading the Takeshi Kovacs trilogy right now by Richard K. Morgan.
Okay.
Don't ever watch. Do not ever watch Altered Carbon on Netflix. Just don't. That's another one that has to be read. But it's not temporally linear, and it will drive you crazy trying to figure out just exactly what, because your mind wants things to go in an A B C D E linear fashion, and that's not how Catch-22 is formatted.
And it takes a while to catch on. Because of my autistic mind, my mind doesn't care if things are in that order. It can figure out the order. It actually kind of enjoys sorting through temporal puzzles. Like, I'll sit there and do time travel paradoxes. I'll just sit down on the couch and think about a time travel paradox for like 8 hours.
Well, keeps you occupied.
Yeah.
Hey, Rick, have yourself a good evening, and my best to Spock. And
he's nomming right now.
Get him some of that Iams wet food. That shit is kitty crack.
I got him the Shiba because he doesn't eat all of it. He doesn't like the meat part of wet food. He likes the gravy.
He must be a Southern kitty.
I don't know.
Any cat that's into gravy is bound to be Southern.
Probably. It's either that or he's Scottish. I'm not sure which, because he'll meow along to bagpipe music.
Well, that's just because he thinks there's another cat in distress.
No, he matches pitch with, like, I was playing Scotland the Brave the other day, and he matched pitch with the bagpipe.
Play it. If I can get his pajamas off, I'm going to fuck. Yeah, that's one of my favorite jokes. Take care, Rick. Have yourself a good evening, my friend.
You too. And right. I'm going to turn on some nice Scottish folk music while I conquer the empire.
Sounds like a lovely idea. It's not like the Scots didn't do that in the first place.
Exactly.
See you later. Bye.
Klingons are just space Scottish anyway. That's why Scotty got along with them so well.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, because every people in Star Trek has an analog to a human society. You know, the Ferengi. Ferengi was merely the Levantine Arabic word for Frenchman.
Yeah, and
you did know that, right?
Yeah, the general idea for the, I believe he did base them on the Normans that invaded, the Norse that came into Scotland and landed in England and did the raiding of Lindisfarne. I think he based the Klingons off of them because he was fascinated with the Highland regiments and their battle prowess when he served in when he like read up on history, Gene Roddenberry, and he was always fascinated with him, and that's one of the reasons he hired James Doohan. It's because he served in the British Army and he was a D-Day veteran. So I never showed his hands up close on film. He was missing one of his fingers, got blown off at D-Day by a machine gunner.
Yeah, I knew that Jimmy Doohan was a veteran, but of course he was Canadian, so
yeah.
Okay. Well, Rick, you have yourself a good evening, all right?
You too. All right. I had a lot of fun. I hope I was enlightening.
No, you were not boring, and it was indeed fun. I love these little discursions. They're good for me. You take care, Rick.
You too.
Bye. Our buddy Rick, from either Illinois or Asgard, kind of depends. And over to the and by the way, 22 minutes left in the program. And $488 to finish the month of March. And thanks again to Stockton Leary. And I'm sorry, I forgot about that. A lot of notes blow past me during the program. Thank you so much. And is that you, Scott?
Yo, that be me.
Oh, okay. Good deal.
Sorry, I'm just terribly confused by technology all of a sudden.
Oh, you?
I don't know what the deal is.
You?
Me, yeah. probably the only weekly program, even the only monthly program that speaks a little bit about ziggurats? Is that what those things are? Those stairway deals up to the hanging garden?
Yeah, smoking ziggurats is really bad for your health.
When I was a youngster.
Wow, just let that one blow right past, did you?
It was good. I don't have a cowbell handy. That's my problem. I have nothing to ring. When I was a child, there was an older kid. Apparently, I was looking in a book that had a line drawing. Obviously, photography was not around when the ziggurats and the hanging gardens were a thing. And he had me somehow convinced. I was about 7 or 8. He had me somehow convinced that the people who built the zigzag stairs, the ziggurats, whatever those people were, that they were responsible for the Zagnut candy bar.
Oh, Jesus, that's a good one.
He led me on for weeks. I would go to the World Book Encyclopedia and try to look it up. I would go to the school library trying to find a book to confirm this. And I never could confirm it, nor could I deny it. And it wasn't until I grew up that I figured that's fucker.
You remind me of freshman year when we had a young student convinced that Naugahyde came from little animals that were grown on the broad grassland prairies of Maryland called Naugas. It wasn't original, but we added our own flavor to it, like the vast grassland prairies of Maryland. I guess Maryland has I guess Maryland has some vast grassland prairies. I mean, I spent 2 or 3 days driving across the eastern shore one day.
Maryland has everything. Maryland certainly do have everything. Well, wouldn't they have to rewrite Home on the Range? Or give me a home
where the
Naugas roam.
Do roam. You need another syllable there, Scott. Where the Naugas do roam, yes.
And the deer and the antelope play.
And the ribbits.
And they're trying for a record contract. Fuck me. I've got two viewing tips that I think the Horn family would enjoy. And these are both, one is vintage, one is less vintage. And you can find these on YouTube. One is a SAG-AFTRA, not a panel, but a one-on-one interview between a lady whose name I cannot recall and Robert Osborne, the longtime host on Turner Classic Movies. Just look up SAG-AFTRA, Robert Osborne, and you'll find it. Wonderful interview with a very knowledgeable man when it comes to, Tinseltown and stars and classic films and stuff. So check that out. And the other thing is a show that ran briefly on ABC television in the 80s, and it would have been around longer had it not been on Thursday nights, I think it was, up against Cosby, for fuck's sake, on NBC. It was a one-hour magazine short sort of show on ABC hosted by Linda Ellerby, who I love, and another gentleman named Ray Gandolf. And it was called Our World. And every week they would take a look back at some segment of time and then go over the historical and hysterical things that happened in that particular period. Our World. It's about time, was the tagline. Those I have spent the last few days looking at all Our World videos on YouTube. What a wonderful show. And who was the programming genius who put it up against Cosby, for fuck's sake? Jesus. The whole idea is plotting out your schedule in prime time is you want folks to view it. You want to have an audience. And I never cared for the Cosby show over on NBC, so I was a faithful Our World fan. But check those out, the SAG-AFTRA interview with Robert Osborne, and check out some of those Our World videos, and you'll thank me later, Warren family. Yeah, Zagnut. it was a candy bar that was that came down.
You know, I always there were two
in those hanging gardens, don't you know? If you tell somebody nuts don't grow on trees, sure they did, up in the hanging garden.
It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. The hanging gardens of Babylon with all those zagnuts dangling from the trees.
And how do you think they got the energy to climb up all those fucking stairs?
And see, when you pick the zagnut before it's ripe, it's a Clark bar.
Oh yeah,
it's a Clark bar.
Oh yeah, yes indeed. I never ate them because I think they had coconut in them, and I wasn't a big fan of them.
I loved zagnuts. I loved them. But the funny thing was, the shelf life was a little sketchy, because it's a similar center. It's kind of a crispy peanut butter center, kind of like the what's in the middle of a Butterfinger.
The Clark Bar years ago.
But with both of those, if you don't get it fresh, it bites off easily. It chews easily. And if it is a fucking minute, a millisecond past its sell-by date, it turns into something you could use as a construction medium.
Yeah, if it's past the expiration date, call your dentist and kiss one of your bowlers goodbye.
And Steve, this was back in the day. This was back in the day before expiration dates. So, I eventually quit buying them because it was just too much of a dice roll, and just get the goddamn Baby Ruth or the Payday and be happy.
There was another, since we're on confection.
Or the Snickers.
There was another thing on the candy aisle. And I remember when candy aisles were bigger. You could line up 5 fourth graders end to end along the candy counter at people's drugstores in Alexandria. And there would still be room for another kid or two. That's how wide the candy aisle, the little display rack at the checkout stand were. We're getting screwed on the candy selection. But another thing that they had it looked like a piece of dowel rod. It was about a half a foot long. And it was like Chico stick.
I knew you were going there because the essential formula of the Chico stick is the same thing that was in the middle of the Zagnut, that was the same thing in the middle of a freaking Butterfinger. Flavor variations, but it's conceptually the same thing. How do we get to these places, Scott?
I don't know, Robin. I just do not know. This is the way my mind goes. You're talking about ancient times and civilizations and construction, and I'm thinking candy bars. What the hell's wrong with me? Come on. The man from the home should be pulling up any moment to carry me off.
With his nice white coat, yes. There's a store in New York City on a street that has no name. No. There's a little shop in New York, and I walked right past it. Our pal Chris in Germany has been there. I know there's a bunch of other people who have too. And for an old school candy aficionado like yourself or me, I didn't get to go when we were there because we just had too much stuff going on. But candy, you think, does not even exist anymore, is to be found there.
I think I've heard of that store.
Oh, it's magnificent.
I believe I have.
You know, when the plague is gone, I got to get back because there's so many things I want to go back to. That little area, there's a pickle vendor who is a throwback to the 1900s.
On the street with the little cart.
These are the real deals, in barrels.
Oh, wow.
And magnificent. I mean, I got kind of close to it back in the summer of 2019 in Philly because they're in Reading Station. There's an Amish shop, and it's like this huge food mall. And Todd in South Carolina, Stan, was absolutely right about it when he told me about it years ago. It was a food porn wonderland. But that Amish shop had real, no kidding, pickles in barrels, too. And of multiple varieties. I brought them home with me and driving pickles 10 hours home after, you know, a weekend in Philly is not for the faint of heart.
I had a
cooler that was nothing but pickles. And for about a year, I rationed those things to myself because they were so freaking good.
So come on down to Robin's Pickle Emporium.
Oh, I got breaking news that is going to make you run dancing naked in absolute, abject, blissful joy when I tell you.
Oh, well, let me sit down. All right, go ahead. I want to hear it.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier about how, Rush Limbaugh, he did. And I had a note from Scott, or a note from Jeremy for you, Scott, who said, can we get a status check on Art Bell and still being dead? Yes, Art Bell is still dead, or else he's Q. And then I just saw this.
That's my theory.
Right. And I just saw this, and Darlene just sent it along, knowing probably how much joy it would bring to your soul. At the tender age of 90, snatched up before his time, G. Gordon Liddy is dead.
Oh, dear. Now, will Satan have him hold his hand above the flames of hell for all eternity? How's that going to work?
I was going to ask the same fucking question. Yes. The guy who told his radio audience back in the 90s, that you want to use your scope and aim for the faces of the federal agents because their body armor and their helmets will stop bullets.
G. Gordon, my God.
But the thing is,
I hadn't thought about him for years.
The story was broken, of course, by the Washington Post, whom Liddy, hated with the heat of a thousand suns. And this provides the truism of the ancient maxim that you never start a fight with anyone who buys ink by the barrel.
Yeah.
Because G. Gordon Liddy is dead, but the Washington Post isn't. And the slug on it is. You know, the shade of Katherine Graham and Ben Bradley are sitting across from each other with a really, really good single batch, single barrel bourbon. And you can hear the ice tinkling in the glass as those two laugh merrily.
Katherine Graham's going to wind up with her tits in a ringer.
Who said that? Was it Nixon?
Wait a minute.
Or was it Liddy?
No, I don't think it was Liddy. Oh, man. I haven't had enough coffee because I got up late. Well, somebody will know. Someone will know.
Could
it have been Charles Colson?
It could have been any of them. But the whole point is, of all the things that G. Gordon Liddy...
It was John Mitchell.
It was John Mitchell. Yeah, okay. I knew we'd get it.
Bernstein, I remember the scene in the movie, Bernstein is calling him for a comment on a really heavy story about the administration and creep and all that. Supposedly he wakes up John Mitchell at 11 o'clock at night. And he reads the first couple of paragraphs, and Mitchell says, "You're going to run with that? You're going to all that crap? You tell your publisher, Katie Graham, you're going to get her kid caught in a ringer." Yeah, it was Mitchell.
By the way, just as an aside, John, have you seen the Trial of the Chicago Seven yet?
Oh, yes, I watched it it was quite good, I thought.
And the guy playing John Mitchell was just perfect.
And oh, who was that? Was it?
I can't remember offhand, but it was just pitch perfect. But anyway, just to get back to the whole, the Washington Post, G. Gordon Liddy may be dead, but the Washington Post is very much alive. And what do you want to bet that this went into his obit? Oh, about 1975. And they've just been waiting to print it because it says, G. Gordon Liddy, undercover operative bungled Watergate break-in, eventually leading to Nixon's resignation. Fuck you! Fuck you, Liddy! Fuck you!
But here's the deal. The break-in that they were caught at, or caught during, was the second break-in.
Yeah.
Not many people recall that. The first one was around Memorial Day weekend, and the bugs weren't working correctly. They weren't getting a good signal. So they had to reassemble the team and go back in to replace the bug. And that's when Frank Wills, doing his nightly rounds, the old lowly Watergate guard, found tape on the door, which he had removed from that same door. And the rest, as they say, is history.
I swear I took this tape off. Well,
I know I took it. They didn't run the tape up and down along where the thing comes out to latch the door. They did it, instead of vertically, they did it horizontally. So that even a casual glance at the door, you would see that the tape was back and something was afoot.
Because they were really right there. I mean, I love the way this is written. Let's see.
Is this the obit in the Post? I've got to follow along.
Oh, yeah. His son, Thomas P. Liddy, confirmed the death but did not give a cause, saying only it was unrelated to COVID-19. Okay, sure.
Denying to the very end.
That looks like another non-denial denial. Oh. Because it's Gordon Liddy, let's say this. Okay, it was only to say that it wasn't COVID-19. What he did not say that it was not HIV/AIDS, because Liddy, he was such a sickening homophobe. Liddy was a theatrical personality whose event-filled career included more twists and turns than a fictional pot boiler. Mr. Liddy was at various times an FBI agent, jailbird. When's the last time the word jailbird has appeared in the Washington Post? I mean, really.
The last time I saw jailbird used in common culture is the get out jail free card on my Monopoly set. I think.
Well, there's the Kurt Vonnegut book, but the word jailbird in a respected newspaper? No, they've been saving that one. No, I don't care. I don't care if he died at 112 and he'd been in prison since he was 10. We are not using jailbird on him. We're saving that for Liddy.
Yeah.
FBI agent, well, jailbird, radio talk show host, best-selling author, candidate for Congress, actor, and promoter of gold investments. His combination of can-do ruthlessness, loyalty to Nixon, and ends justify the means philosophy made him a natural fit in a White House determined to get even with its political enemies. At the same time, he was viewed. At the same time, he was viewed by his superiors as a little nuts. See, I always thought that Colonel Flagg in the MASH TV series was based on Liddy.
You might be right. I know that character, and that is Liddy-esque, I believe.
And by the way, that term "a little nuts," those are the words of Richard Milhouse Pinhead Nixon himself. He's a little nuts, Henry. I mean, Jesus HR. I mean, he just isn't well screwed on, is he? Again, the words of Richard Nixon.
What cable news outlet is John Dean working on these days? Because you know he's going to be on tonight.
Oh, yeah, they got on the blower to John Dean in a hurry.
Oh, my. Well, this is, I do not have, I do, even the, my bitterest enemy, I don't have what, you know, joy, or I'm not thrilled by the passing of anyone. But in G. Gordon's case, I will make an exception. Another thing that I'll bet you can find on YouTube, there for a while, I guess, to raise money for his legal defense, Liddy used to do a stage debate, quote, in air quotes, with none other than Timothy Leary. And if you've ever read Liddy's book, which I have, I took one for the team years ago, when Liddy was an FBI agent, he had a hand in a drug bust, an LSD drug bust on, at some upstate New York mansion where Liddy, where Timothy Leary and his man, merry band of acid heads were all living, like a commune in a mansion. And Liddy had a part in that bust. This was years ago, back in the 60s, before he got into, you know, political stuff. And, somewhere that you can probably find videos of the quote debates between G. Gordon Liddy and Timothy Leary. And they were a hoot, as I recall. I haven't seen them for a while, but, they were a hoot. They were probably both working on their bail money,
and you know, Liddy was a complete clown, and I loved the way and this has special relevance to me because there's a quote from Stanley Cutler of the University of Wisconsin. I had the distinct honor and privilege of meeting Stanley Cutler and having dinner with him and long conversations about Watergate, and I think I even had him on the program once because no one knew more about Watergate than Stanley Cutler. And he described Liddy as a spear carrier following the wishes of his commander-in-chief, who will merit no more than a footnote in the history books. And the director of the National Security Archive, Tom Blanton, said Liddy brought out the worst in Nixon, raising the testosterone level in the White House and ratcheting them up to even more extreme action. And here's one of the things that most people don't know. He was sentenced to 20 years in federal prison. And he started serving that sentence and had served 4 years and 4 months of it when his sentence was commuted. Do you happen to recall which president commuted his sentence?
What year would it have been? Well, that would give it away. Well, let's see now. Was it Jerry? It couldn't have been Jerry Ford.
It was Jimmy Carter.
Well, maybe you.
That incredibly decent human being, Jimmy Carter.
Why? I mean, I'm all for mercy. I'm as much for mercy as the next guy. But this motherfucker, G. Gordon Liddy,
tried to overturn the government of the United States of America. Yes.
Oh, but it's worse. It's more detailed than that. He went to the office of John Mitchell, the Attorney General of the United States, and set up his easel and his flip chart, and was giving the various options of dirty tricks that the GOP could do in anticipation of the 72 election cycle in the fucking office of the Attorney General. I don't even think Bill Barr had the nastiness. Well, of course, now we don't know yet. The papers have not all been released to the archives. So maybe, you know, in modern day G. Gordon Liddy set up his, well, he wouldn't have an easel. He'd have a PowerPoint presentation, whoever the modern guy is. But yes, he deserves every nasty thing that can be said about him, because while proclaiming to be a decent, honorable American, he was rat-fucking the country and shitting on the Constitution is what he was doing.
Yeah, and of course, you are. And the fact of the matter is, Scott, these hyper-masculine, flag-waving types are all the same. He was 2 years in the Army as an artillery officer, but hey, when it came time to go and get shot at in Korea, nope. He was exempted for medical reasons.
Old no-show Liddy. Gee. Well, what are they going to do with his body? You want that polluting the earth?
You know, I remember my father saying that H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman and Gordon Liddy were all a bunch of goddamn Nazis. That's a quote. And lo and behold, he described his wife, the former Frances Purcell, in the memoir that he wrote that sold over 1 million copies, called Will. He said she was he said his wife was a legendary Rhine maiden. Really?
Oh, there you go. And a gun nut, as I recall. Mrs. Liddy was a gun nut.
Well,
you know, it's funny, and I probably shouldn't even be saying this, but back when I was still a 411 operator in the D.C. area, I looked up his name. His number was non-published, but his address was there, and at the time he was living in Oxon Hill, Maryland. And I don't know why I didn't go over to say hello, bring him a covered dish or something, poop, maybe, but I didn't. I guess the statute of limitations is expired because the operators were not supposed to access the database without a request from a calling customer. So Ma Bell, come get me. Come on. I've got my pea shooter, and I'll beat you to death with a chicken stick.
There we go.
Sitting on this hill.
Well, I'm glad you called, because I can't think of anyone that I would rather celebrate the journey into hell of G. Gordon Liddy with than you, Scott. You.
You think Nixon and Colson and Haldeman and Ehrlichman have saved him a seat at the table there in that area of hell? You think there'll be a barbecue? You think they'll sway the fat
reverse pineapples, Scott. Reverse pineapples.
All around, yes. We got a big one here for you, George Gordon Liddy. Come on down.
George Gordon Battle Liddy. Yes.
Battle?
Yep.
Oh, mercy.
Mm-hmm.
Mercy. Well, tonight, in his memory, I will light a candle and hold my palm over it.
Anyway, you know, he wasn't even original. He said the trick to that is not minding that it hurts. And you know, he stole that from Lawrence of Arabia. It's one of my favorite scenes where Peter O'Toole as T.E. Lawrence lights a match and then puts it out with his finger very slowly. And then the young Corporal Potter tries it and goes, "That bloody hurts! What's the trick?" And Peter O'Toole, with that lovely voice, looks at him, that soft, lovely voice, and says, "The trick, young Potter, is not minding that it hurts." And so that's how he described the holding the hand over the candle flame thing. It's not minding.
Yeah, and didn't he eat a rat?
Yeah, he ate a rat.
And ate a rat?
Yeah, long before. Everything's derivative, you know. Ozzy Osbourne and bit the head off of whatever, you know. Yeah. And eventually.
It was a piggy.
And you know, in the case of Liddy eating a rat, that was just cannibalism.
That was what? Cannibalism?
That was just cannibalism. Fuck it, I'm giving myself a cowbell for that. A rat eating a rat, cannibalism? Got to work with me here, Scott.
No, he was not a rat. A rat is one who squeals. Well, that's a pig, technically. But a rat is one who squeals on his co-conspirators. So maybe that's why he ate the rat, because the rat squealed, thinking it was a pig. I don't know. I've gone down the rabbit hole. Oh, another animal. Oh, now we've got bunny. Show me the rabbit, George. Show me the rabbit. God damn, Robin. You better let me go, or I better. Let
yeah,
you
I think
go
we're gonna. We're gonna knock off here before the hallucinations kick in. I'm not gonna tell
I'll
you. I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna tell you about the bats.
Until the cows come home.
I'm not gonna tell you about the bats, you poor bastard. I'm not gonna tell you about the bats, you poor bastard. You'll see them soon enough.
Oh dear, here they come, fear and loathing at my house. All right.
No ether, Scott.
Well, thank you for the joy of
for the
news.
Happy news.
George Gordon Battle Liddy is no more. He is rowing down the the curtain eternal or whatever it is. He's sung.
Yeah, Stephen New York, by way of postscript, Stephen New York says, Lydian Hell, he's on a gun range having to shoot for eternity at a target with blanks.
All right.
Scott, well, talk to you later.
I will talk to you later. No, you won't talk to me later. I'll talk to you later, damn it.
Yeah. Right. If you get there first, you make a mark. If I get there first, I'll rub it out.
All right. And good night, Horn family, wherever you are.
Indeed. Later, Scott.
Bye.
That's our buddy Scott. We ran a little bit over, but that's okay. Makes for good radio. This is two straight nights of good fun that we've had while dealing with a whole bunch of insane and annoying and positively ludicrous information. Thanks to all of our subscribers, Patreon and PayPal. Remember, we don't have a single subscriber on the 30th, if anybody would like to be that. Thank you to our a la carte contributors. Thank you, Samson, this evening. Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks so much, Joey and Giraffe, for the challenge. Thank you to each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this little conversation in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky in the chat room. I didn't see if Steve popped in at any point in time. Nope. Thanks just the same. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. HeadOn.live. Remember, brand new Fresh Malloy on the way in about 48 minutes. 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 6 p.m. Pacific. The best place to listen to the first run of Malloy is HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. Remember, if you have not yet done so, please write, email, call your member of the House of Representatives, especially if they're a Democrat, and tell them to sign on to H.R. 2073, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. It is of utmost importance to the people of Appalachia, and it'd be a good thing for America generally, because that coal serves no purpose other than making coal barons rich. Yeah. And, you know, killing coal workers and killing innocent Appalachian people. And that, right. Do, please. And don't just, you know, call once and forget it. If you haven't heard from them, call them back in a week. They're used to it. Be polite, but tell them it really matters to you as one of their constituents. Please. And always, Gina, it's all for you. Please stay safe. Get your vaccine as soon as you can. Schedule your second one if it's a two-shotter. Keep washing your hands. Keep wearing your mask. Keep double masking. Keep using hand sanitizer. Keep carrying it with you everywhere you go. Maintain your social distance, 15 feet between people wearing masks and, well, 15 planets orbiting triple stars for people without masks. And, of course, if somebody comes towards you saying, well, I don't know, I think that G. Gordon Liddy's a little bit nuts, Henry. Avoid that person like the plague, because he is. Later.